President Trump imposes new sanctions on Iran as the U.S. tries to build a coalition to deter attacks in the Persian Gulf or the Gulf of Oman. It's Monday, June 24th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good afternoon. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Coming up, the White House has already imposed more than 1,000 sanctions on Iran in the past year. So what will the latest step accomplish?
We have sanctions to go after the Supreme Leader's office and lock up literally billions of dollars more of assets.
Also this hour, why illegal marijuana cultivation and sales are still prevalent and even growing in states that have legalized the drug, and how market forces are driving a solar energy boom in Georgia, where there are no state mandates promoting it. It's 4:01. First, this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump is imposing additional economic sanctions against Iran in response to Tehran downing a U.S. military drone, calling Iran's actions aggressive. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says these are on top of already crushing sanctions that are in force against Iran.
These are highly, highly effective on locking up the Iranian economy. And as the president said, we look forward to a time in releasing sanctions if they're willing to negotiate.
Iran's hardline state media says the sanctions are based on fabricated excuses. The Trump administration wants international partners to join forces to increase maritime security in the Strait of Hormuz. That's the area where the U.S. says Iran attacked two oil tankers recently. Tehran denies that claim. President Trump today said other countries, including China and Japan, should protect their own oil tankers in that key waterway. A Texas congresswoman says the federal government has removed most of the children from a remote U.S. Customs and Border Patrol station after reports that there were hundreds of children held without adequate food, water, and sanitation. The Associated Press reports Congresswoman Veronica Escobar says there are 30 children left at that facility near El Paso as of today. It's not clear where all the children were moved to. Meanwhile, Border Patrol agents have found four bodies by the Rio Grande in Texas Rio Grande Valley. Texas Public Radio's Ronaldo Lianos Jr. has more.
The Hidalgo County Sheriff Eddie Guerra tweeted last night saying that Border Patrol agents came across four bodies by the Rio Grande, southeast of a wildlife management area. The FBI is leading the investigation and says that three of the deceased are children and the other is an adult woman. The FBI says it appears they were undocumented immigrants, and as of right now, there are no signs of foul play. The agency also says it appears they died from dehydration and heat exposure, but the next step will be to conduct an autopsy. Authorities will contact the appropriate consulate, and the consulate will notify their relatives. Last year, there were 283 deaths across the southern border, with the majority of them happening in the Rio Grande Valley. For NPR News, I'm Reynaldo Lianos Jr. in Mission, Texas.
Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders released a plan to eliminate all student debt, and NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben explains.
Sanders today released a plan to eliminate $1.6 trillion in student debt. The plan would also make public universities, community colleges, and trade schools tuition-free. The Vermont senator said he would pay for the proposal with a tax on some financial transactions, like stock trades. Other candidates, including Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and former Housing Secretary Julian Castro, also have student debt plans, but not as large as Sanders. A recent Fed analysis showed that student debt is keeping young adults from buying homes, but some critics of these plans say they could disproportionately help higher-income Americans. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. The man police say is responsible for driving a truck into a group of motorcyclists and killing seven people is being transported from Massachusetts to New Hampshire. 23-year-old Vladimir Zhukovsky was arraigned in Springfield today. He faces negligent homicide charges in New Hampshire. Defense attorney Donald Frank says he hopes people will respect his client's privacy.
This is a tragedy. It's a real tragedy for all of those families. I read the newspaper accounts. I don't know anything more about it than that. But he is still innocent until proven guilty.
The victims of Friday's crash in Randolph, New Hampshire, were part of a group of Marines and their spouses. MBTA officials are forming an independent review panel to assess safety practices in Boston's transit system. WBUR's Jerome Campbell has this report.
The panel consists of experts who have led New York's transit system and the Federal Transit Administration, as well as former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood. Their goal will be to examine past incidents on the T, like this month's derailments on the red and green lines, and recommend changes. Monica Tibbetts-Nutt sits on the MBTA's governing board and says the review panel is a serious effort to hold the transit system accountable.
So I just want the public to know we are going to be transparent, we are going to work as fast as we can, and we are all pulling in the same direction to not only improve our processes, but to improve the services.
The review panel is expected to announce what they will focus on in the coming weeks. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jerome Campbell.
After a day of disruption, service is back to normal on the D branch of the T's Green Line. Shuttle buses replace trolleys between Riverside and Reservoir for most of the morning and afternoon. T says the changes were the result of a wire problem that has now been fixed. It's getting cheaper to drive to your summer getaway. AAA now says a gallon of gas costs $2.64 in Massachusetts. That's down 3 cents from last week and is 2 cents lower than the national average. Speaking of summer getaways, three sharks spotted today in the waters off of Cape Cod. The Chatham Harbor Master spotted a great white this morning off the southern tip of Monomoy Island. Two other sharks were spotted this afternoon just outside of Wellfleet Harbor. In sports, the U.S. women's soccer team is moving on to the quarterfinals. After beating Spain 2-1 today, they'll play France on Friday. Red Sox start a three-game set with the White Sox tonight at Fenway. In the forecast, increasing clouds tonight, lows around 60 degrees. Showers moving in tomorrow morning after the commute with a possible thunderstorm later in the day. Highs in the lower 70s. Right now, 76 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. After President Trump announced last week that he had called off airstrikes against Iran, he promised to take other non-military measures to increase pressure on the country. Now, today, we are getting a sense of what those measures are. A new set of sanctions and an effort to build up a maritime coalition in the Persian Gulf to deter further Iranian attacks. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
President Trump is now taking aim at Iran's supreme leader and is expected to single out Iran's foreign minister for sanctions later in the week.
Sanctions imposed through the executive order that I'm about to sign will deny the supreme leader and the supreme leader's office and those closely affiliated with him and the office access to key financial resources and support.
He calls it a strong and proportionate response to Iran's provocative actions. Last week, the president cited concerns about potential casualties when he called off a military strike against Iran that had been drawn up in response to the downing of a U.S. drone. Asked whether the sanctions were in response to that, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says, in part.
Some of this was in the works. Some of this is a result of recent activities.
And not just the downing of the drone. The Trump administration also blames Iran for recent attacks on tankers in the Gulf of Oman. Iran says it won't negotiate under pressure, or as its ambassador to the UN has put it, with a knife at its throat. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates today as he tries to build up a coalition to deter Iran. Special Representative Brian Hook was separately visiting Oman, describing his meetings this way.
We've talked about ways that we can enhance maritime security and do what we can to restore deterrence in this part of the region, which needs to be more stable and more secure.
U.S. officials are calling it the Sentinel program. The idea is to keep eyes on all shipping in the region. Officials won't say what countries are likely to join or what exactly they will do. As one U.S. official put it, there will be cameras, binoculars, and ships, including from the U.S. As he sat down with Emirati leaders today, Secretary Pompeo made clear that President Trump is keen to share the burden. Pompeo calls on military folks in the United Arab Emirates to participate in the maritime security effort and says another 20 countries are needed for what's likely to be a lengthy campaign. Elon Goldenberg of the Center for a New American Security was working in the Pentagon when the Obama administration faced similar challenges from Iran in 2011 and 12.
And what the U.S. did at that moment was less loud huffing and puffing, more quiet signaling, very firmly signaling to the Iranians in private that this was unacceptable, And if they kept going, they risked a major conflict with the United States.
He says that message got through loud and clear. The current point person on Iran, Brian Hook, says there are no back channels operating now with Iran, but he insists the Trump administration is giving Iran what he calls off-ramps. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
So is this new policy on Iran loud huffing and puffing or a strong and proportionate response? Well, for one view on it, we are joined by Suzanne Maloney. She was an advisor to the State Department on Iran issues during the George W. Bush administration, and she is now with the Brookings Institution. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we heard the president say that these sanctions are going to deny access to key financial resources from the senior leaders of Iran. Do you have a sense of what exactly the sanctions are going to do?
I think that may be a bit of an overstatement about denying key economic resources to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran is already heavily sanctioned. In fact, many of the organizations and institutions that are associated with the Office of the Supreme Leader that were highlighted in today's announcement have already been subject to American sanctions. I think the purpose of the announcement today was, at least to some extent, about the huffing and puffing that Ilan Goldenberg mentioned in the prior commentary. But it's also, I think, a reaction to some sense that there was an appearance that the policy had begun to soften a bit because of the president's decision not to retaliate and some of his seemingly conciliatory rhetoric over the weekend.
Right. So after a year or so of what the Trump administration describes as a maximum pressure campaign on Iran, how do you increase the pressure from maximum, I guess, is the question.
Well, and that's the dilemma that the administration is beginning to face, that once you've sanctioned all of the major industries and sectors of the Iranian economy, there's very little that you can do that's not already redundant or just largely incremental. It also, I think, highlights the fact that the Iranian economy, what's left of it, has become more insular and less interconnected, which means whatever economic activity continues in Iran today is going to be more resilient to U.S. penalties.
Now, the White House says this is all a means of getting Iran to the negotiating table. Do you think these steps are likely to do that, are likely to have that effect?
I think it's very much unclear that new economic measures are going to really create an incentive for the Iranians to come to the negotiating table. In particular, the threat, as we've heard today, to sanction the Iranian foreign minister would seem to fly in the face of any real effort to negotiate. That said, I think there is some constituency on the part of the Iranian system to try to see what might be possible, to explore what might be viable in terms of some kind of a quid pro quo with the Trump administration, simply because they're so aware that the president himself appears to be fixated on the possibility of some kind of symmetry with Iran.
Do you think there's a risk that increasing the pressure will lead Iran to be more aggressive and take more steps like shooting down the U.S. drone as it did last week?
Well, I think we were likely to see that in the aftermath of the events of last week, President Trump's decision to reverse his initial support for a military strike on Iran and then tweet about it publicly, I think was likely read as weakness from the Iranian leadership. And fundamentally, they haven't gotten what they need out of this escalatory strategy. They're looking to see a mitigation of economic pressure, and they haven't seen that yet.
That is Suzanne Maloney, a former Iran expert from the George W. Bush administration. She is now with the Brookings Institution. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The country's biggest e-cigarettes company, Juul Labs, calls San Francisco home. That has not stopped the city's Board of Supervisors from taking up a vote tomorrow. It is considering a bill to ban the sale of e-cigarettes. Reporter Laura Clivens of member station KQED has the story.
15-year-old Abby Chaitin has lived in San Francisco her whole life. She doesn't really see the draw of using e-cigarettes, which her friends just call vaping.
Because I've noticed how addicted my peers have become to, like, vaping.
She sits on her bed in her purple room. There's a Breakfast Club poster on the wall, and you can see San Francisco's summer fog out her window. She told me the majority of her friends have tried vaping, and a few are now hooked.
I'll see them in class, like, fidgeting, or, like, they need it to focus, to function.
Last year, one in five high school seniors reported vaping in the past month. That's almost double the number who reported vaping the year before. Even eighth graders are vaping in record numbers.
We're going to fight hard to stop that.
San Francisco supervisor Shimon Walton co-authored the new ordinance.
We spent a few decades fighting big tobacco in the form of cigarettes, and now we have to do it again in the form of e-cigarettes.
The proposed law would ban selling e-cigarettes in the city and delivering them to San Francisco addresses. That means you couldn't even order them online. In California, it's illegal for anyone under 21 to buy tobacco products, both regular and e-cigarettes. Still, Walton says vaping devices are common in the city's middle and high schools. He points out that nicotine, no matter how you ingest it, can harm a young person's developing brain.
And now we're just trading one nicotine addiction for another.
Juul's vaping device, also called a Juul, was introduced in 2015. The company now controls 70% of the vaping market. Company officials say they also want to keep e-cigarettes away from young people. They say they've made it harder for underage buyers to purchase Juul off their website, and Juul shut down its accounts on Facebook and Instagram. But the company argues banning e-cigarettes will mean adults who want to quit smoking regular cigarettes will have a harder time. San Francisco resident Jay Friedman agrees. The software engineer used to smoke a pack a day for 20 years.
E-cigarettes have really gotten me down to smoking like two or three a day.
Friedman supported a ban on flavored tobacco that city voters passed last year.
I feel like it was a good step to get rid of the fruit flavors for kids, but this feels like maybe a step too far.
He says if e-cigarettes are banned, he would try to quit nicotine altogether. But
there would be a point and a moment of weakness where I'd just end up buying a pack of smokes again, and then it's just a slippery slope from there.
City supervisors worry that for every adult that might benefit, dozens of young people could become addicted. Small businesses in San Francisco are concerned the ban will hurt their bottom line.
Hey, how's it going?
Miriam Zazunis and her family own this convenience store near downtown San Francisco, Ted's Market.
When people come and want to purchase something at the store and we don't have that exact item that they want, they're not going to buy the rest of the items that they might on that trip, a drink or a sandwich, if we don't have their type of tobacco product.
She says sales from e-cigarettes are at least $200 to $300 a day. And as a board member of the Arab American Grocers Association, she believes laws like this mostly affect immigrant-owned businesses. If passed, the ban would go into effect early next year. But 15-year-old Abby Chaitin thinks it won't make much of a difference.
People my age can find a way around that if they really need to.
Meanwhile, Juul is collecting signatures for a ballot initiative to override the ban in November. For NPR News, I'm Laura Clivens in San Francisco.
And this story is part of a reporting partnership with NPR News, KQED, and Kaiser Health News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Brilliant Earth, conflict-free diamond engagement rings, wedding rings, and vintage fine jewelry. Online at brilliantearth.com and their Newbury Street showroom. Appointments available now.
This is WBUR, online at WBUR.org. Coming up on All Things Considered, why Georgia's solar power market is booming despite the lack of state mandates supporting it. On Wall Street today, it was a mixed day for the markets. The Dow was up 8 points at 26,727. NASDAQ fell 26 points to 8,005. The S&P 500 lost 5 points to end the day at 2,945. Remember, coming up at WBUR City Space on Tuesday, July 16th, a screening of a new documentary about legendary 60 Minutes reporter Mike Wallace, who interviewed some of the most important figures of the 20th century. Go to WBUR.org/cityspace for details. In the forecast, we've got clouds rolling in overnight and rain tomorrow. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
A beautiful afternoon out there. Temperatures in the 80s, 70s at the coast will fall down through the 70s, 60s, and eventually right around 60 by tomorrow morning. There may be an early shower tomorrow and then a better chance for some downpours in the afternoon. It's muggy. We're in the lower 70s. And then it's a summer stretch Wednesday through Friday. We'll see partly to mostly sunny skies. There might be an afternoon pop-up storm. Temperatures will be in the 80s during that period.
Right now it's 77 degrees in Boston at 420. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from the Alzheimer's Association, working toward a vision of a world without Alzheimer's, providing care and support to all those facing the disease with a commitment to advancing critical research. More at alz.org. And Teradata, committed to transforming the way business works through the power of data, Teradata leverages data across the enterprise on a single platform to deliver answers to today's complex business issues. Teradata.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As states consider what, if anything, to do about climate change, one thing more than half of them have done is set mandates around renewable energy. In many places, that's driving the growth of wind and solar. But it's not happening everywhere. Today and tomorrow, I'm going to take you on a road trip to a state that proudly has no such mandate, Georgia. My home state. Again, no mandates requiring clean energy, and yet Georgia is in the middle of a solar power boom. And I can tell you that with confidence because I just drove it top to bottom. We started in Dalton, North Georgia, near the Tennessee state line. When I was a kid growing up in Georgia, when someone said Dalton, you said Corpus. I mean, this was a one-horse town for a long time.
Oh, absolutely.
Dalton Mayor Dennis Mock, who assures me Dalton is still, quote, the carpet capital of the world. They make all kinds of floor coverings, actually. Laminates, hardwood, tiles. And then, last year, a company from Korea came knocking.
They showed up, we liked them, and they liked us, and that's how it works.
The company was Hanwha Qcells. This January, 5 months ago, here in Dalton, Georgia, production began at the biggest solar assembly factory in the Western Hemisphere.
When we go out on the floor, there are a lot of moving pieces, so if we can all stay together.
Our guide, Lisa Nash, she helped hire the 600 people this factory now employs.
We've just stepped through a couple of double doors onto the main factory floor. It's about a football field and a half long, getting the lay of the land of the production line here.
Actually, three production lines side by side, operating 24/7. Around us, solar cells are getting slotted into frames, workers are checking for defects. I'm trying to wrap my head around the scale of the place when a kind of critter forklift approaches.
What are these little robot cars I just saw scooting around?
Those are heisters.
Heisters. They're basically unmanned forklifts, and they are hauling pallets of finished panels around. Almost all the machinery here was shipped over from Korea, so the final solar product could be assembled here in Georgia. And my question for Scott Moskowitz, Director of Strategy and Market Intelligence, is why? Why Georgia?
Why Georgia? Well, first of all, the U.S. is the second largest solar market in the world. It will be for the foreseeable future.
He's led us up to a conference room. We have peeled off the big plastic goggles and paper booties we were required to wear on the factory floor. Moskowitz says locating in Georgia made sense in part because a lot of customers want to do the tour we have just done, see firsthand how their panels are made.
The vast majority of these will end up in projects in the U.S. and many of them in projects in the Southeast because this is the largest region for solar installations over the next 5 years.
So demand is high.
Demand for solar is high and growing.
Then there's the matter of tariffs. Scott Moskowitz says they were already eyeing the U.S. market when President Trump slapped a 30% tariff on solar imports. Just 4 months later, May 2018, Hanwha Qcells announced this plant.
Tariffs have made it such that for the time being, this is the most attractive place to assemble panels for use in the U.S. market.
Okay, now let me introduce another player on the solar scene here in Georgia, Facebook. Yes, Facebook is headquartered on the other side of the country, but they are behind one of the first orders for this factory in Dalton. Last year, around the same time Hanwha Qcells was sniffing around in Dalton, Facebook announced plans to build a giant data center just a couple of hours' drive southeast. So we point our car down I-75 towards our next stop.
I have now driven out east of Atlanta. We're in Newton County, Georgia. I'm looking out over a massive building site with cement mixers and dumpsters and all kinds of construction equipment. This is the future site of what a lot of people we've met here in Georgia are describing to us as a game changer for solar in Georgia.
That is because the building taking shape in front of me, when it comes online next year, it is going to require as much energy as a small to mid-size city. Facebook's data centers house the servers that process every time you like a post or comment on a friend's. Paul Clemens runs the Facebook team that scouts new locations. He told me when he originally came hunting a couple years ago, he noticed something.
It's very sunny in the south part of Georgia, yet renewable energy was not really taking off in the state.
Which he saw as an opportunity. The field was wide open. Facebook could tailor the kind of solar deal it wanted in Georgia. And market forces were cooperating. The price of solar has been falling and falling more than 70% over the last decade.
We found that when we go into new regions and we're able to access renewable energy, that we typically are able to achieve lower electricity rates than we would through a normal non-green energy solution.
Which matters because Facebook has set a company goal: support all its electricity needs with 100% renewable energy by next year. Here in Georgia, the utility that is giving Facebook access to all that renewable energy is Walton EMC, headquartered about 20 miles back north from the Facebook construction site. We roll up and are greeted by
Greg Brooks, and I'm the Community and Public Relations Director.
Brooks says his customers want solar, big customers such as Facebook and your everyday Joe. But some people's roofs are too shady, some people don't want solar panels on top of their houses, some people can't afford them. So Brooks brings us out to see one of the community solar installations they have built, kind of sort of like a community garden. So it is a scorcher of a day here in Georgia. It's going to be 90-something degrees again. We've just driven to, you said this is the smallest of the community lots you've got going?
4,200 panels, takes about 6 acres.
How this works: if you are a Walton EMC customer, you can opt to pay $25 a month. You get a block of solar panels in the community plot and a credit on your bill. It has been popular. So popular, the first two installations sold out in days. Now, renewables account for a tiny fraction of the energy mix Walton EMC provides customers.
It is still less than 1%.
That is soon to change, though, thanks to Facebook. The amount of power that Facebook will gobble up means Walton EMC has to build a couple new solar plants to serve them. I mean, how big a deal is that for a company like Walton EMC?
It's a huge deal.
A game-changer kind of deal, or?
I would say so. We're actually getting calls from other companies now. Their corporate philosophy and policy is that they want to do renewable, too.
Now, I should point out the obvious. Solar does not work at night, does not work when it rains, so there are going to be times when Facebook will have to rely on fossil fuels. When the sun is out, those new solar farms will send more clean energy to the grid than Facebook can use during the day, and that excess will count towards their renewable energy goal.
Solar is a valuable piece of the energy mix, but I don't ever see us going to 100% of any one fuel source.
Then again, Greg Brooks never thought he would be standing here in 2019 next to rows and rows of solar panels talking about the solar boom in Georgia.
Even 10 years ago, I didn't think so because it was so expensive. It's amazing. To me, this is the most fun project I've worked on in my career.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Why?
It kind of gets us back to our roots because the people we were invented to serve planted something in a field and the sun shined on it, and they harvested that crop. And we planted these solar panels out here, and we're harvesting what the sun has given us to serve our members. So that's kind of neat.
Now, land near Atlanta is expensive. So the solar farms for Facebook, they are going up in the south of the state. Our road trip continues tomorrow. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. Coming up on All Things Considered, what happens to Syrian refugees who heed the government's call to return home? Many have been imprisoned. We'll get that story and more coming up on WBUR. Forecast says increasing clouds tonight. Lows around 60 degrees. Right now, 77 degrees in Boston at 429.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by The Cabot in Beverly, presenting Art Garfunkel. The legendary 8-time Grammy-winning singer and Rock and Roll Hall of Famer performs Sunday, July 14th. Tickets at thecabot.org. Gregorian Oriental Rugs, custom and designer sample event going on now. Room-size hand-knotted rugs in modern and transitional styles. GregorianRugs.com. And Peabody Essex Museum. See outstanding examples of American painting, furniture, and decorative arts from the collection of Carolyn and Peter Lynch, now on view. PEM.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. You may know Dave Isay as the founder of StoryCorps. We'll talk with him about his latest project, hearing from LGBTQ elders like this one for the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots.
And there was this one particularly outrageously beautiful queen, and she was asking them not to push her. And they continued to push her, and she turned around and she mashed the cop with her high heel.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Tomorrow at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump is imposing additional sanctions against Iran after calling off a military strike over the downing of a U.S. surveillance drone last week. NPR's Mara Liasson has the latest.
President Trump signed an order that he says will impose hard-hitting sanctions on Iran. It will deny Iran's supreme leader and other top Iranians access to financial instruments. The president said he plans to increase pressure on Tehran so that they will never get a nuclear weapon. This comes after Trump ordered, then reversed himself on a military strike against Iran after Iran shot down a U.S. drone.
I think a lot of restraint has been shown by us, a lot of restraint, and that doesn't mean we're going to show it in the future.
President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the nuclear deal and placed crippling economic sanctions on Iran in the hopes Iran would agree to a different deal or change its behavior. But that has not happened. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
As activists continue to highlight the deplorable conditions of thousands of migrant children being held in overcrowded detention centers, Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar says his agency is running out of time and money to deal with the problem.
At some point in early July, we're going to probably be out of money, and that's why Congress has got to act now. We got to get the House and Senate to just pass a unified package as quickly as possible. This is not political. This isn't about immigration policy. This is just about getting these kids cared for, getting it funded, and moving on.
House Democrats have unveiled a $4.5 billion measure to respond to the growing humanitarian crisis at the southern border. The bill is scheduled for a vote later this week by both the Senate and House before agencies caring for the influx of migrants run out of money next month. Stocks finished mixed today on Wall Street as gains for tech companies were offset by losses in healthcare and other sectors. You're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. A West Springfield man's now been charged in a deadly crash in Randolph, New Hampshire that killed seven motorcyclists. Vladimir Zhukovsky was arrested this morning and arraigned in court this afternoon in western Massachusetts. He is being charged with seven counts of negligent homicide for last Friday's crash. Police say he was driving a truck that collided with the bikers. They were part of a motorcycle club for Marines and their spouses. The only Republican member of Congress from New England will face a Democratic challenge if she runs for re-election next year. Two Democrats have now come forward to say they'll run for the seat held by Senator Susan Collins. The latest to join the race is Maine's Democratic House Speaker, Sarah Gideon. Gideon made that announcement today. Democrats have criticized Collins for voting to confirm Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell is pushing city education leaders to begin the process of making the district more equitable. Campbell's releasing an action plan to improve Boston public schools. She says it would increase the number of high-quality schools, make registration sites easier to navigate, and update the school assignment process. Campbell says improving schools should be a priority for everyone.
This is an issue not only of equity, of significant importance when it comes to young people reaching their dreams and for our job market. It also has economic impact. These are taxpayer dollars used for a system that should be supporting all of our families.
Campbell says she's meeting with incoming BPS Superintendent Brenda Casilius tomorrow to discuss the plan. New research from Harvard Medical School suggests having the right kinds of bacteria in your gut could help you get more out of your workouts. WBUR's Kyrie Thompson has more on the study.
The paper published in the journal Nature Medicine shows that the gut bacterium Vianella metabolizes lactic acid in tired muscles. Alexander Kostick is an assistant professor of microbiology at Harvard Medical School and an author on the study. He says researchers are now looking at whether treatments of Vianella could eventually help people with diabetes and heart disease live healthier lives.
Is it possible that we can isolate these strains from athletes, colonize them into people at risk for these chronic diseases, and help them increase their exercise capacity and stave off these diseases?
Kostick says marathon runners often have higher amounts of Vianella than the average person. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Kyrie Thompson.
In the forecast, increasing clouds tonight, lows around 60 degrees. Showers move in tomorrow morning after the commute with a possible thunderstorm later in the day. Highs in the mid-70s. Right now, 77 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform, featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at zoom.us. And Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at indeed.com/hire.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Over the weekend, the White House released what it calls a new vision for building the Palestinian economy. Tomorrow, Presidential Advisor Jared Kushner convenes a workshop in Bahrain to ask countries and investors to pitch in $50 billion to underwrite this vision. The White House, though, has not said if it will contribute, and for a year, the U.S. has been cutting aid money to the Palestinians. Meanwhile, the Palestinians have already rejected this economic plan. NPR's Daniel Estrin joins me now from Jerusalem. Hi, Daniel.
Hello there.
Hey, so start with some detail on this plan. What exactly is in it?
It's a list of more than 100 projects talking about upgrading infrastructure and economy and hospitals and trade for Palestinians, which are all things that Palestinians really, really need. This plan is talking about creating 1 million jobs, about doubling the Palestinian GDP. And actually, a lot of the projects that the White House is proposing are things that USAID had been doing, but that the Trump administration simply defunded over the last year.
So, reception in the region. We mentioned Palestinians have already rejected this plan, and the Israelis are not even invited to this conference tomorrow. Is that correct?
That's right. The White House says it's not inviting Israeli officials because it doesn't want to politicize this event. Several Arab countries are going to this event, but they're quite skittish about being there when the Palestinians are completely and utterly rejecting the U.S. approach. The Palestinians say their economy is being held back because of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Israeli restrictions on things like building infrastructure in the majority of the West Bank. Jared Kushner, who is the president's man putting all this peace plan together, says the Palestinians are missing the opportunity of the century. And here's what Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas had to say about that. He said, we are not going to be slaves or servants to Kushner and his team. You know, and his main point is, yes, Palestinians need money, but Palestinians need independence more.
It sounds, Daniel, as though quite the challenging table being set before they even get underway tomorrow night in Bahrain. What are you expecting to actually come out of this meeting?
That's a really good question, Mary Louise, because it's a series of panels discussing things like healthcare and upgrading the Palestinian infrastructure. There will be some Israeli private sector people there. There will be Arab investors there, American investors, but no sense whether there's actually going to be money put on the table if no one knows what the second half of the Middle East peace plan is, which is the political half. Jared Kushner says he's only going to present that part later this year.
Okay, so this is the economic slice of the U.S.-led
right.
efforts for peace in the Middle East. We watch and wait to see what may happen on the political side.
Exactly.
I want to ask before we let you go, Daniel, about another gathering. There are meetings underway and involving U.S. officials, also Russian officials. What's going on?
Right. Well, National Security Advisor John Bolton is here, and tomorrow he is meeting his Russian counterpart and his Israeli counterpart. They're going to be discussing Iran and Syria and regional issues. And defense analysts in Israel say this is basically what they expect to happen. Israel wants Russia to make Iranian forces leave Syria. And in return, the U.S. and Israel may offer a gesture acknowledging the reality that Assad will stay in power in Syria. We'll have to wait and see what comes out of the meeting.
Okay, so this is all about Iran and U.S. and Israeli efforts to get Russia on board with where they want to take that situation. All right, NPR's Daniel Estrin tracking a lot of moving parts there from Jerusalem.
That's right.
Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome.
As the war in Syria winds down, President Bashar al-Assad is calling on the millions of Syrians who have fled to return home.
Of course, they can come back without any action taken from the government against them. We want people to come back to Syria.
Activists and human rights workers doubt Assad's words. They say many Syrians who have returned to areas under his control are being detained, imprisoned, and often tortured. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports.
The Syrian refugee who comes to our bureau in Beirut late one night is pale from too much time spent indoors. These days, he rarely ventures out. He's skinny, in his 20s, and only wants us to refer to him by his nickname, Abu Ez. Syrians like him are no longer welcome in Lebanon.
If I get stopped at any checkpoint, I might be deported.
Abu Ez knows too well the dangers of returning to Assad's Syria, or even being identified for this peace. He won't go back home, not after what happened to his brother-in-law. Abu Ez's brother-in-law, Abu Ammar, we won't use his full name, was a rebel fighter in the early days of the war. Then he fled to Idlib, which is still under rebel control. But he hated being so far away from his family in Homs.
He sent me messages telling me about how people are living in tents, and the tents are so close to one another that his neighbors can hear everything he says.
So, Abu Ez says, his brother-in-law decided to contact an intermediary for the regime. The government has set up reconciliation committees to offer amnesty to opposition activists and fighters. Abu Ammar returned to Homs and obtained a document.
The document said that everything is okay, that everything from his past is forgotten. But there's nothing that is forgotten in Syria.
Reunited with his wife and four children, Abu Ammar worked to rebuild the bakery that had been his business before the war. He was so happy to be back. The reconciliation process works, Abu Ammar told his brother-in-law, Abu Ez.
He really felt safe. He told me with confidence, you should return and finish your studies and maybe even join the police or military.
This was the last time they talked. 10 days later, Abu Ez received a message telling him that his brother-in-law had been arrested. Security forces had stormed his home. A helicopter hovered overhead.
At first, my sister refused to tell me about it. She was afraid the phone was tapped. She didn't want to say the regime took him. Eventually, she admitted some men had put him in a car.
Days passed, then weeks. Now it's been almost a year with no news. Abu Ez says his sister and family in Homs are too afraid to even go and ask the government where Abu Ammar is. They also fear arrest. This story is typical of the testimony being heard by Elizabeth Zirkoff, a Syria researcher who spent months gathering data on people returning to regime-held areas. She says all kinds of people are being detained all over the country.
They're former activists, former members of local councils, doctors who worked in opposition-run hospitals, and they are sometimes commanders of rebels who have gone through reconciliation with the regime.
Some of the detained are falsely accused of rebel connections. In all, she says, at least 1,000 people who thought they'd reconciled with the regime have disappeared. Abu Ez watches all this from Lebanon. Despite the insecurity and harassment in Lebanon, he says he has no choice but to stay here. And his advice to fellow Syrians returning home? If you go back, you're gambling with your life, he says. You're playing with fire. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Beirut.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Cannabis is one of Colorado's most infamous exports. Marijuana is legal in the state, but it is illegal to take it across state lines. Cops admit they will never come close to eradicating the problem. The financial incentive to break the law is just too great. From Colorado Public Radio, Ben Marcus has our story.
You'd think it'd be hard to surprise George Brockler. He's been a prosecutor in Colorado for decades.
I've never seen the black market for marijuana as robust and as expertly cultivated, forgive that pun, as I have right now.
Brockler says that's thanks to legalization. People can grow small amounts themselves. There's a large thriving industry. And for those who do grow illegally, sentencing is lenient. All of that, Brockler says, makes this a great place to hide a black market operation.
Today, Colorado announced a massive marijuana bust, years in the making, with charges from racketeering.
El Paso County Sheriff's Office busting another illegal marijuana grow operation this morning.
This one east of Colorado Springs along Ellicott Highway.
They're busting down doors and seizing marijuana plants. It's a scene that's played out at dozens of locations across the metro area today.
And these illicit grows are often found in suburban homes and expensive neighborhoods. Brockler recalls one bust in a 55 and older community a few months ago.
Ultimately, they pulled out, I think it was 1,000 to 1,100 plants out of one home. So you got to wonder, how do you walk around in there without feeling like you're in that movie Children of the Corn or something?
And in late May, the biggest bust of them all, 80,000 plants, 2 tons of finished cannabis product, all of it destined for out of state. For the simple economics of it.
Because you take $1,000 worth a pound of, I guess, of marijuana out here, and it's about $4,000 to $5,000 out in Florida.
Where Brockler says there are no recreational stores, and that's still the case for the vast majority of the U.S., especially in the South and the East Coast. John Bolduc is superintendent of the Nebraska State Patrol. He says his troopers continue to seize a lot of marijuana on its way to places like New York and Florida, coming from legal states.
Certainly Colorado is one of them. We see a lot of marijuana from Oregon. We see a lot from California. We're seeing some from Nevada.
The California Highway Patrol reports seizing almost 8.5 tons of marijuana last year. And over the last 2 years, another 7 tons came out of Oregon. Cops in Colorado seem to agree that the problem is not licensed cannabis grows.
Well, because the regulated growers have way too much to lose.
That's Dean Heiser, chief counsel for LiveWell, a large chain of marijuana dispensaries in Colorado. He's in one of his stores in an industrial section of northeast Denver. On display, walls and walls of products, from vape pens to edibles.
Our plan is to, and goal is to make sure that a consumer can go one place and get what they want.
He says so much money has been invested in these places and the grow operations that feed them that any association with the black market would be foolish.
And to be honest with you, the little bit of money that you might be able to make diverting product compared to the risk that you would take and the jail time that you might serve and frankly the headlines that you might make, it's just not worth it.
But Colorado District Attorney George Brockler says criminal activity is like water. It finds a way. Brockler, a Republican, says the only thing that will reduce demand for Colorado marijuana is more states legalizing it and meeting their own demand.
And I don't wish that on them. That's a decision for them and their voters. But just economics tell you that that's true.
He says as long as marijuana fetches exponentially more money out of state, Colorado's black market may never be stopped. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, we go to Fall River and learn about a quirky local specialty. Remember, if you have a car or boat you're thinking about replacing, consider giving it new life by donating it to WBUR. Station will get top dollar for it to help support the news, and you could get a tax deduction. Learn how at WBUR.org/cars. In the forecast, increasing clouds tonight, lows right around 60 degrees. Showers move in after the morning commute tomorrow with rain and a possible thunderstorm later in the day. Highs in the mid-70s. Right now, 78 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Boston University's Graduate Tax Program. Advance your career with an LLM or master's degree in tax law, open to tax, legal, and business professionals. And the Mercedes-Benz CLA with a turbocharged engine and 7-speed dual-clutch automatic transmission. Dealer locations at mvusa.com.
We go where the nation asks us to go, and we do what the nation requires us to do.
The Navy SEAL who oversaw the mission that took down Osama bin Laden is now retired. His new memoir recounts 37 years of service and credits others who put their lives on the line to help him succeed.
I certainly didn't make it to where I was as a result of my own wonderful talents.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR News station.
On a Monday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Our next story is about a sort of sandwich that is also a noodle dish. Locals in Fall River, Massachusetts call it the Chow Mein Sandwich. Sarah Mises-Tan of member station WCAI takes a bite of this dish that smacks of the city's factory worker past.
A large chicken chow mein.
Okay, I'll get the bill. Okay.
The Chow Mein Sandwich is in some ways exactly how you would imagine it. A portion of fried chow mein noodles with gravy poured over it, served on a simple, no-frills hamburger bun. The dish has been a specialty of Chinese restaurants in the area for decades.
We have people come from New York, Chicago, and it's so funny, they will whisper to the server, to say, do you have those burger sandwich? I said, you mean the chow mein sandwich? I said, yes, we do.
That's Regina Mark, the co-owner of Mi Sum Restaurant in Fall River, a place that's been making chow mein sandwiches for over 50 years. She says the sandwich's popularity was due in large part because of the city's factory worker population in the early 1900s.
Fall River is very booming with factory textile industry, and mostly a lot of worker. That's why chow mein sandwich sell over here.
When Chinese immigrants first started arriving in Fall River in the late 1800s, many were coming from the West Coast, pushed out by hostility caused by the Chinese Exclusion Act. They opened restaurants, but in a town that was mostly factory workers from Ireland and Poland, Chinese restaurants had to adapt. Imogene Lim is a professor at Vancouver Island University who studied the sandwich for her anthropology dissertation.
If you're thinking immigrant groups, what do they know about Chinese food? But they know something called a sandwich. So a sandwich becomes something accessible to them as a way to ease in that notion of Chinese cuisine.
Chinese restaurant owners realized that if they put a hamburger bun on top, they could make an unfamiliar dish seem more approachable to European immigrants. The result is that Fall River immigration created a sandwich that's neither Chinese nor Irish or Polish. It's American. Back at Mi Sum, Regina Mark shows me first how to prepare the noodles for a proper chow mein sandwich.
Because we like to keep it nice and hot, we dip it in the fryer.
She piles hot noodles and chicken on a bun, and then it's ready for the gravy.
See how we pour it on? And we come over here for the gravy. Put a bun over here. All right. I want you to try it.
Okay, and that's it.
That's it. Oh my
God. I use a fork and take a bite. The noodles have just the right amount of crunch, and the restaurant's secret gravy recipe offers a nice counterpoint to the crispy noodles. It's a warm and comforting sandwich. Dave Lucier grew up eating chow mein sandwiches with his family in Fall River, and he says it's the noodles that set them apart.
So you get special noodles that give you a lot of chicken. It's delicious. You know, it's kind of a joke that it's a sandwich because you can't pick it up.
He adds that for a true Fall River touch, you can top it off with vinegar. The dish is such a classic Fall River food that back in the 1970s, a band called Alika and the Happy Samoans even wrote a song about it in tribute.
Chow mein sandwich.
In the end, Regina Mark says the sandwich may seem an odd creation by today's standards.
And now we're laughing about chow mein sandwich, right? But, I mean, that's our business. It put a lot of kids to college so they can find a better job now, get themselves a better education.
In many ways, it's the classic story of any immigrant reaching for the American dream. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan in Fall River, Massachusetts.
A new album of violin concertos combines unlikely bedfellows. One is romantic and tuneful. The other is audaciously avant-garde. Our reviewer, NPR's Tom Heisinga, has been listening and says this odd couple makes for a compelling album and also a great introduction to a violinist who has persevered through tragedy.
Augustin Hadelich is among today's top violinists, and one of the pieces he's chosen to record with the Norwegian Radio Orchestra is the Brahms Violin Concerto. There are already over 100 recordings of the work to choose from, though, so who needs another? But Hadelich makes a solid case for the music, allowing his instrument to sing as sweetly as any of his peers. Hadelich is an intimate communicator with his 1723 Stradivarius, but he also has a secret sauce for this Brahms, and it's in the cadenza. That's a passage in concertos where the soloist gets to show off with a solo. For this recording, Hadelich has composed his own cadenza. Like building a house in a historic district, the violinist respects the architecture of the neighborhood, but his design is fresh. Hadelich is 35 years old and makes it all sound easy. But his road to success wasn't. He gave his first concert at age 7, but when he was 15, an accident on his family's farm in Italy left his face and his right hand badly burned. Some doctors doubted he'd ever play the violin again. But after surgeries and physical therapy, he won a prestigious competition. His career was launched with a technique that blends lyrical elegance and flexible strength. And that's what you need in spades to play the other concerto on this album by the modern iconoclast George Ligeti. Ligeti's concerto from 1992 is a ferocious and fascinating ride. The composer filters old musical formulas through his kaleidoscopic lens, pushing the soloist to the brink. Hadelich masters all of Ligeti's tricks, every nuanced color and ethereal sound the instrument can make. And the chaos is followed by moments of serene beauty. Hadelich brings his secret sauce to this concerto, too, with another brand new cadenza. This one was written for Hadelich by Thomas Addis, the masterful British composer, and it dovetails perfectly into the concerto's slam-bang final notes. It's the most astounding passage of the entire album. When Augustin Hadelich first saw the score, he thought it was unplayable. But it became just one more roadblock this singular violinist has vaulted over in his blossoming career.
The album features violin concertos by Ligeti and Brahms. Our reviewer is NPR's Tom Heisinga.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. Duolingo, a language app whose mission is to make language learning fun and accessible to the world. With lessons in more than 30 languages, including French, Spanish, and Chinese. Available in the App Store or at Duolingo.com. And Trader Joe's, where new products arrive in stores weekly and new episodes of the podcast Inside Trader Joe's arrive online occasionally at Apple Podcasts and where podcasts are found. More at TraderJoe's.com.
This is WBUR online at WBUR.org. Coming up next hour on All Things Considered, the legal battle over whether the last facility in Missouri that performs abortions can stay in operation. In the forecast, increasing clouds tonight, lows right around 60 degrees. Showers move in tomorrow morning after the commute, rain and a possible storm later on, highs in the mid-70s. Right now, 78 degrees in Boston at 4:59.
Funding for WBUR Weather Reports comes from GEICO, offering the GEICO mobile app, which stores ID cards and enables bill pay and claim reports directly from your cell phone. Learn more at geico.com.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at CitySpace, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Democrats and Republicans discuss a possible compromise on immigration and a U.S. asylum law, though the two remain far apart. It's Monday, June 24th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good afternoon. I'm Jack Lepiarz, in for Lisa Mullins. Coming up, we'll talk with the number two Democrat in the Senate on the likelihood of a near-term compromise on asylum law changes. Also this hour, the White House considers requiring hospitals and insurers to give patients price estimates up front, but some say it could actually increase prices.
Patient empowerment, of course, requires transparency around price and quality.
And after U.S. cyber attacks on Iran over the weekend, why they have become the preferred method for the U.S. to send messages overseas instead of military force. It's 5:01. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump has signed an executive order to impose more sanctions on Iran and several specific Iranians. The Treasury Department says it is going after the Supreme Leader's office and will soon do the same with the country's foreign minister. Here's NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin named several of the new targets, including commanders of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which was recently added to a U.S. terrorism blacklist.
For people who say these are just symbolic, that's not the case at all. We've literally locked up tens and tens of billions of dollars. These sanctions will come along with additional entities where people are hiding money. So, no, these sanctions are highly effective.
He says Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, will soon face sanctions, too. This follows Iran's downing of a U.S. drone last week. Zarif says it crossed into Iranian territory. The U.S. accuses him of disinformation. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in the United Arab Emirates after holding meetings in Saudi Arabia aimed at building a global coalition to counter Iran. Pompeo, in a statement today, says he met with Saudi King Salman to talk about heightened tensions in the region and maritime security in the Persian Gulf. The UAE is also a close ally and has been a member of the Saudi-led coalition at war against Iranian-allied rebel forces in Yemen, where the small Gulf kingdom is wary of direct conflict with Iran and has called for diplomacy in the current U.S.-Iranian standoff. President Trump is renewing his attacks on the Federal Reserve today. NPR Scott Horsley reports Trump complained via Twitter the central bank should be acting faster to lower interest rates.
In a pair of tweets this morning, Trump accused the Federal Reserve of acting, quote, like a stubborn child with its decision to leave interest rates unchanged last week. He added for emphasis that the central bank, quote, blew it. Trump has repeatedly complained that the Fed could be doing more to prop up the economy, and he blames last year's rate hikes for slowing economic growth. Fed officials agree there are worrisome signs of a slowdown sparked in part by the president's trade war. The Fed has stressed it's prepared to lower interest rates if necessary. That signal sent the stock market to new highs last week, but Trump insists both the market and the broader economy would be even stronger if the Fed had been willing to cut rates sooner. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Supreme Court is rejecting an early challenge to President Trump's authority to impose tariffs on imported steel based on what the administration has labeled national security concerns. Justices ruling to leave in place a decision by an international trade court that ruled against steel importers and other users of imported steel, who challenged a 25% tariff put in place by the Trump administration last year. A mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow gained 8 points to end the session at 26,727. The Nasdaq fell 26 points. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. Federal transportation experts will begin reviewing safety on the MBTA. T officials say a three-member independent panel will look into current safety practices and past incidents on the system. Board member Monica Tibbetts-Nutt says the panel is an effort to make larger change.
I just want the public to understand that we are being held accountable for this. And it's not just looking at the safety, but looking at the way that we deliver our services.
The panel was convened after two derailments this month on the red and green lines. Boston police are investigating shootings that injured four people and killed another. The department says the shootings happened at four different locations yesterday across the city between 3 and 11 p.m. One victim has life-threatening injuries. One person shot on Duke Street died. A West Springfield man's been charged in a deadly crash in Randolph, New Hampshire that killed seven motorcyclists. Vladimir Zukovsky was arrested this morning and arraigned in Massachusetts. He's being charged in the Granite State with seven counts of negligent homicide for last Friday's crash. Police say he was driving a truck that collided with the bikers. They were part of a motorcycle club for Marines and their spouses. The Atlantic White Shark Conservancy says three great white sharks were spotted today off Cape Cod. A 13-foot shark was seen just off Monomoy Island eating a seal. Two other sharks were reported off Wellfleet Harbor. That as state and local leaders and conservationists consider ways to address the number of sharks in Cape waters. Last year, Cape Cod saw its first fatal shark attack in more than 80 years. In sports, the U.S. women's soccer team moves on to the quarterfinals in the World Cup after beating Spain 2-1 today. They play France on Friday. Red Sox start a three-game set with the Chicago White Sox at Fenway tonight. In the forecast, increasing clouds tonight, lows around 60 degrees. Showers tomorrow morning with rain and a possible thunderstorm in the afternoon. Highs in the mid-70s. Right now, 77 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by LaSalle Village in Newton. Engaging retirement living on the LaSalle College campus. Call now for available one-bedroom units. LaSalleVillage.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, driven by one goal, ending homelessness for good. Learn more online at MelvilleTrust.org and on Twitter at MelvilleTrust.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 2 weeks. That is how long President Trump says he is giving lawmakers to sort out a solution for the southern border. If not, he tweeted, deportation start. Now, this is all in the wake of his threat to launch immigration raids this week across the U.S., raids the president called off, quote, at the request of Democrats, end quote. Well, let's bring in a Democrat. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, he joins me now. Hi there, Senator.
How you doing?
I'm well, thank you. I want to ask, were you among those calling on the president to reverse himself on these raids?
Well, I certainly did. There were many of us who think the idea of mass arrest and mass deportation are going to result in terrible human and family outcomes. Imagine that child coming home from school to find the empty house if the parents have been deported.
We at NPR interviewed on Friday the head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. This is Mark Morgan, the acting ICE director. He told us, look, my agency has no choice but to enforce the law. If you don't like it, lawmakers can change it. But if we don't go out and knock on doors and arrest people who have entered this country illegally, that undercuts the rule of law. How do you answer that, Senator?
I listened to that interview. And I thought to myself, Mr. Morgan, you have a choice here. You have 11 million people who are technically out of legal status in the United States. Well, the highest priority is to take those who may be any danger to us whatsoever, criminal records and the like, and to make sure they are deported. But if you're going to go out and, in a broadcast fashion and just take anyone who falls into the net and say, you're gone, you're going to be ignoring the reality that many people who are here are living in households where there may be one undocumented person and otherwise a family of American citizens, all following the law, all doing the right thing. The priority should be remove those who are dangerous to America first.
Well, let me just see if I can pin you down quickly in terms of where things go next. I said this suspension is temporary. The president says you guys have got 2 weeks to figure out a solution on the border. Is it clear to you what would need to get done in the next 2 weeks to satisfy the president?
I have no idea what will satisfy this president. I've been down this road so many times where he sets goals, we meet them with legislation, and he walks away from them. He's a very difficult man to bargain or deal with when it comes to the issue of immigration, and the reason's obvious. When he ran for president, he made it clear to America he would be tougher on immigration than any president in recent memory. And he certainly has, from the travel ban all the way to the current times with zero tolerance and families being divided. Yet look at our border now. The worst breakdown we've seen on our southern border in modern memory under this get-tough president. Could it be that is not the approach that will work? I hope we can do it on a bipartisan basis.
You and Senator Graham, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, did meet last week with the president's son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner. Y'all were talking about changes to asylum laws, as I understand it. Did that lend you to any optimistic view in terms of that there may be a path forward for, A, a plan that could win bipartisan support, and B, that could win the support of the White House?
I don't know if we can reach that point. I've had a good working relationship with Senator Graham. We have many, many differences, but when it comes to immigration, we've worked hard to find common ground, and I'm willing to try again. But we need a spirit of good faith and willingness on both sides, Democrats and Republicans. And for goodness sakes, as we start talking about getting tough at the border, let's not take it out on the kids.
And do I hear you correctly? You're saying you do see a path forward in terms of working with Republicans in Congress. It's the White House that is the obstacle, as from where you sit?
Well, I don't know if they're an obstacle. I will tell you that I sat down with Senator Graham last week. I said, here are five things we're ready to agree on today. Let's do it on a bipartisan basis. If it's not enough, we can return and try again. But let's not waste our time with a political standoff.
Senate Minority Whip Dick Durbin. Senator, thanks so much for your time.
Good to be with you.
Another immigration story that we are following today, Customs and Border Protection has reportedly moved hundreds of children out of a temporary holding facility in Clint, Texas, after multiple reports on unsanitary conditions there. One of the people who raised the alarm was Alora Mukherjee. She's director of the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. She visited the center near El Paso last week, where more than 300 migrant kids were being held. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
What's your take on this move by CBP today?
CBP is trying to move children out of Clint, which is in the spotlight, and to other facilities. We don't know where those children are being moved. We don't know if those facilities have the same appalling conditions that we've seen in Clint, Texas. Last week in Clint, we saw hundreds of children who reported, we interviewed many children who said that they were hungry. They were obviously dirty, they were sick, they were scared, and they'd been detained by Customs and Border Patrol for weeks on end, some for nearly a month. And the other facilities may have similar problems. We have learned that some of the children have reportedly been moved to a facility outside of El Paso where our team also went last week. At that facility, there were also not sufficient access to toothbrushes, to showers, to beds for children to sleep in. So we need to investigate where the children have been moved and what the conditions there are.
So your concern is that CBP is responding to complaints about one particular facility rather than complaints about a system that subjects children to these conditions in a variety of facilities. Is that right?
That's exactly right. A 2008 law that was passed with unanimous bipartisan support and signed by President George W. Bush requires that children be in CBP custody for 72 hours, 3 days or less. And we need to know that the children that have been moved out of Clint have been released from federal immigration custody. Every child we spoke with has family members in the United States who are desperate to have their beloved children back. And those children belong with their families. They do not belong in detention.
Tell us a little bit about the conditions that you saw when you visited this Clint facility last week.
The children are hungry. They're not being given enough food. They're given the same food day after day. Many of the children have had no opportunity to take a shower or a bath since crossing the border weeks ago. There is a stench that emanates from the children because they haven't had an opportunity to wash their clothing. They are wearing the same clothes for weeks that they crossed the border in. There are very young children, 1, 2, 3 years old, who are being cared for by older children who are not related to them. And when I say older children, I mean 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds. The children are locked in their cells and cages for long periods of time, nearly all day. Most of the children who I spoke with have no opportunities to go outside.
Wow. Now, Customs and Border Protection says that they are doing the best they can with limited resources, and they just need more money for more facilities and more beds. In our last 30 seconds or so, do you agree that that is the needed solution?
The needed solution is that the administration follows the law. The law requires that children not be detained in these facilities for longer than 72 hours. We need congressional hearings immediately to investigate the conditions in which children are being held across the border, as well as adults. And all children deserve access to basic hygiene items such as soap and showers and toothbrushes, which many of the children at Clint were not given.
Laura Mukherjee of Columbia Law School, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
To another story now, the cost of medical procedures. The real cost is often a huge mystery to patients, and it can vary hugely from hospital to hospital. President Trump today signed an executive order he says will address that. It asks the federal government to draft rules requiring hospitals and insurers to post prices in a way that is easy for consumers to access.
And you'll get great pricing. Prices will come down by numbers that you won't even believe. You won't even believe it. More price transparency will mean more competition, and the cost of health care will go way, way down.
All right. We are joined now by NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Hey there.
Hello.
How exactly is this supposed to work?
Well, the idea here is that more transparency will mean that patients can make more informed decisions about their care. They could choose a cheaper option, or they could choose a more highly rated provider. And for people with high deductibles or no insurance, this could make a difference in their daily lives. But the challenge here is that even with a lot of information, it's hard to shop around in healthcare because you trust your doctor. You trust the person they tell you you should go see. Or it's hard because you're sick and you're in a hurry and you don't have time to shop around.
I mean, the argument, as we heard President Trump making, is that forcing hospitals to publish their prices will lower prices, will create more competition that we will all shop around. When you have spoken to healthcare experts and asked them, do they agree that this is what would happen?
No, they don't necessarily agree that because healthcare is simply not a normal market. Price doesn't necessarily drive people in the same way that it would if you were shopping for a car or
for the
groceries.
Reasons you just mentioned. Mm-hmm.
Right. Also, most people have insurance, and so they aren't price sensitive in the same way. If you're paying a $30 copay, no matter how much it costs, then it doesn't really matter. It doesn't drive your behavior. And the other thing, though, is that there are people, including in the industry and beyond, who are saying that this could have unintended consequences. The president is calling for the prices that insurers negotiate with hospitals to be made public. And a number of people have told me that this could actually cause hospitals and physicians to ask for higher reimbursements going forward. Bill Pierce is a senior director at APCO Worldwide, but he's also a former HHS official under the George W. Bush administration. This is how he described it.
Five doctors, five insurance companies, one guy is getting $200 for a physical and the others are all getting $175. Everybody's going to $200 when the next negotiation comes. They're going to go, no, want $200. That's a problem.
Tam, just a few seconds left, but will we patients see changes along these lines soon?
Not quickly, because this is a rulemaking process. It is a long process. And then once this information becomes available, it's not clear whether the market effects will be what some expect.
NPR's Tamara Keith, our White House correspondent. Thanks, Tam.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Lisa Mullins. Your support of WBUR could be doing even more for you. Find out if your employer will double or triple your gift by visiting WBUR.org.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Brigham Health, where doctors, nurses, and researchers work together to translate breakthrough science into leading-edge treatments. This relentless will to provide clinically excellent, compassionate care helps patients achieve the best possible health outcomes. Learn more at brighamhealth.org.
This is WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, presidential candidate and Mayor Pete Buttigieg faces new scrutiny after another police-involved shooting in his town of South Bend, Indiana. On Wall Street, a mixed day for the markets today. The Dow was up 8 points at 26,727. NASDAQ fell 26 points to 8,005. The S&P 500 lost 5 points to end the day at 2,945. More business news coming up at 6:30 on Marketplace. Right now, the time is 5:19.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by New England Honda dealers, presenting the all-wheel drive 2019 CR-V and Pilot. You can learn more at HondaDealersOfNewEngland.com. Around here, we Honda. And BU School of Social Work. Earn your MSW online from anywhere in the U.S. with top-ranked BU. BU.edu/SSW/online.
In the forecast, increasing clouds tonight, showers and rain tomorrow. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
After a beautiful day, it's a nice evening. It's warm. Temperatures are in the 80s over inland areas, falling through the 70s along the coast. Late at night, we'll see clouds increase, temperature at 60 or so by morning. Tomorrow, an early shower, but a better chance for afternoon downpours. It's muggy tomorrow. We're in the lower 70s. On Wednesday, partly to mostly sunny skies. There might be a pop-up shower or a thunderstorm. Temperature in the low to mid-80s. On Thursday, we're in the mid to upper 80s. Lots of sunshine. Just a very small risk of a pop-up storm. Friday's beautiful, 85 to 90. And right now, the weekend also looks warm and humid.
Right now, it's 76 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Tire Rack. For the past 40 years, Tire Rack has remained committed to helping people find the right tires, wheels, and performance parts. Learn more at TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, and install. And Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil. Metamucil Premium Blend contains plant-based psyllium fiber, is made with natural flavors and colors, and is sweetened with stevia leaf extract. Learn more at Metamucil.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. At a town hall meeting yesterday in South Bend, Indiana, locals laid into their mayor for his handling of a fatal police shooting earlier this month.
Get the racists off the streets! It's disrespectful that I wake up every day scared.
The mayor hearing and responding to all of this, of course, is Pete Buttigieg, one of the candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination.
We have tried but not succeeded to increase diversity in the police department, and we need help.
After months of generally positive attention on the campaign trail, this conflict is calling attention to Buttigieg's record on race and policing in South Bend, where he has been mayor since 2012. Lincoln Wright is a reporter who covers these issues for the South Bend Tribune. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard from that tape how intense emotions were at the town hall. Remind us of what the incident was that led to all of this frustration within South Bend's Black community.
Yeah, a white police officer shot and killed, his name was Eric Logan, a African-American man, about a week ago. The officer did not activate his body camera footage, so right now it's just his word of what actually transpired that early morning.
And part of the reason the community is so angry about this is that this is not an isolated incident. What has Mayor Pete Buttigieg's record in South Bend been in the 7 years since he's become mayor on race and policing?
Well, yeah, so unfortunately, this is by far not the first officer-involved incident that has caused outrage in the community over racial tension. He has often, he always, after these incidents, does speak to the community, does bring people to the table. But I think it was one of our city councilwomen at this town hall said she doesn't see anything changing.
I understand 5% of the police force is African-American compared to 25% of the population of South Bend.
That is correct. Yeah, the police department is 88% white. And so they're policing a, like you said, a city population of that's 26% African-American.
And there was also an issue with Buttigieg dismissing the African-American chief of police.
He had just taken office when he did that. So, but he even has admitted that was maybe one of his first big mistakes as far as how he handled that situation.
I'd like to ask you about a quote that the former head of the Congressional Black Caucus, Congresswoman Marsha Fudge, gave to the Daily Beast. She's from Ohio, and she said, "Pete has a black problem. I don't know of one black person out of Indiana that supports him." That's a really strong statement. When you talk to African Americans in Indiana, do you find universal dislike and lack of support for Mayor Buttigieg, or is it a little more nuanced than that?
It is definitely an issue, but there still are a lot of leaders in the African American community here who are standing by Pete right now, and they're not saying there's not a problem. They're saying something needs to be done, but they're stepping up and saying we're going to work with Pete to find a solution. But no, there definitely is people in the community who do not support Pete.
When you go out and talk to African Americans in South Bend, what are the typical things that they tell you about him?
Well, it's more just the handling of the police department. I mean, he's even admitted that the minority recruiting has been a huge problem, is the biggest problem. But the community is saying at this point, there's just a lack of trust. I mean, people at the town hall flat out told him, "I don't know if I can trust you in the police department."
That's Lincoln Wright, a reporter with the South Bend Tribune in South Bend, Indiana. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Today on All Tech Considered, living in a world where anyone can be a social media influencer. Influencing took off years ago with reality stars such as the Kardashians leading the way. Now companies are hiring regular people to post about themselves on platforms such as Instagram and Snapchat. This is raising alarm amongst consumer rights groups, as NPR's Jasmine Garst reports.
In the photograph, Gretchen Altman is smiling, leaning back casually, a cup of coffee in hand. Hills Brothers coffee, to be precise. It looks like a candid shot, but if you hit like, leave a comment, and tag a friend, you can get 3 different blends of brew for free.
They approached me, and I sent them my rate sheet, I sent them an invoice, and we agreed on a set number of posts.
Altman's going rate is $300 to $800 to promote something. She does some posts in exchange for free goods, she says, as long as it's stuff she believes in. Altman doesn't have the 140 million Instagram followers of Kim Kardashian. She has around 6,000. That makes her a micro-influencer.
I'm just living a normal life, and people relate to that. They just feel like I'm a friend of theirs.
Bonnie Patton, the executive director of Truth in Advertising, says
it works. Consumers are very apt to buy things that they see being promoted on social media, especially by people they feel they have some sort of authentic, natural connection with.
This worries Patton and consumer rights groups. Several recent studies have found that young audiences are largely unable to understand when something is sponsored content.
Do you know a woman who needs a brand new wardrobe all year long?
In this Instagram post, Jonathan Van Ness, star of Netflix's Queer Eye, is excited about a clothing rental service.
We're going to try on clothes. We're doing the most. We're doing everything. Love you guys. Happy holidays. Yes!
In this case, Van Ness's post is clearly labeled as an advertisement. But what happens when it's an everyday person with just a couple thousand followers?
The problem with a lot of these social media posts is that you don't know whether it's an ad or not.
What Patton wants is transparency in social media advertising. That nutritional shake, that tooth whitener that will make you look like a Cheshire cat. Patton wants influencers to be clear that they're getting paid to recommend it, which means including the hashtag advertisement or sponsored content. Ultimately, consumer advocates say the buck stops with the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, which several watchdog groups say has done little in terms of enforcement.
Unfortunately, the FTC does not have the resources to police social media platforms to the extent necessary.
NPR reached out to the FTC, who referred us to their guidelines. If you're getting paid to promote, quote, then a disclosure is appropriate, end quote. To be clear, Gretchen Altman is diligent about using those hashtags. She loves what she does and sees it as a business. She doesn't necessarily want to be a social media celebrity.
With social media being so integrated into our everyday lives, we have this unique opportunity that I don't think anyone has ever had before, where we can each be our own brand.
For many, the very idea of everyday people becoming brands sounds like a nightmare capitalist dystopia. Professor Salim Alabash teaches public relations and social media at Michigan State University. He says there are bigger implications to this. When the lines between what is real life and what is marketing get blurred, It changes people's behaviors.
You always need to be doing something exciting. Taking pictures of your food, taking pictures of your feet by the beach. It becomes so important for people to be liked and appreciated that they always have to almost live another person's life.
He, like many, wonders, what are we buying into when we're all trying to sell something? Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And from Ultimate Software, dedicated to putting people first, with solutions for HR, payroll, and talent management. Learn more at ultimatesoftware.com.
This is NPR News.
This is WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, why cyber attacks have become the U.S.'s preferred method for sending a message to other countries. In the forecast, increasing clouds tonight, lows around 60 degrees. Right now, it's 76 degrees in Boston at 529.
Funding for WBUR weather reports comes from GEICO, offering the GEICO mobile app, which stores ID cards and enables bill pay and claim reports directly from your cell phone. Learn more at geico.com. Other supporters include the Harvard Art Museums, open to everyone 7 days a week. Take a closer look, harvardartmuseums.org. And the Trustees, presenting New Horizon by artist Doug Aitken, July 12th through 28th. thetrustees.org/newhorizon.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. You may know Dave Isay as the founder of StoryCorps. We'll talk with him about his latest project, hearing from LGBTQ elders like this one for the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots.
And there was this one particularly outrageously beautiful queen, and she was asking them not to push her. And they continued to push her, and she turned around and she mashed the cop with her high heel.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Tomorrow at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A Texas congresswoman says immigration officials are removing children from a squalid Border Patrol holding facility in West Texas after lawyers complained the minors were being held in dangerous conditions. NPR's John Burnett says the lawyers said older children were left to care for the younger ones.
Kids sleeping on concrete floors, no soap, no showers, sickness, older children trying to take care of inconsolable toddlers. These were the descriptions of lawyers who visited the immigrant holding facility in Clint, Texas. A Democratic member of Congress from El Paso, Veronica Escobar, reports that an official with Customs and Border Protection told her most of the 300 kids at the station have been relocated. About 30 remain there, according to the AP. The visiting lawyers condemned the inhumane conditions. Even Vice President Mike Pence has called them totally unacceptable. CBP said in a statement that its short-term holding facilities were not set up to handle vulnerable immigrants, such as children, and it implores Congress to pass additional humanitarian funding. John Burnett, NPR News.
President Trump is imposing additional sanctions against Iran after calling off a military strike last week over the downing of a U.S. surveillance drone. Trump signed the executive order today, increasing pressure on Tehran so, in his words, they'll never get a nuclear weapon. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says the sanctions come on top of those already in force against Iran.
Along with our existing sanctions authorities, we have additional sanctions to go after the Supreme Leader's office and lock up literally billions of dollars more of assets.
Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is now talking with officials in the Persian Gulf to build an international coalition with Asia and Europe against Iran. Stocks finished mixed today on Wall Street. You're listening to NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. The man police say is responsible for driving a truck into a group of motorcyclists and killing seven people is being transported from Massachusetts to New Hampshire. 23-year-old Vladimir Zukovsky was arraigned in Springfield today. He faces negligent homicide charges in New Hampshire, and defense attorney Donald Frank says he hopes people will respect his client's privacy.
This is a tragedy. It's a real tragedy for all of those families. I read the newspaper accounts. I don't know anything more about it than that. But he is still innocent until proven guilty.
The victims of Friday's crash in Randolph, New Hampshire, were part of a group of Marines and their spouses. State government will be funded even if a budget is not passed in time for the fiscal year that starts 1 week from today. House and Senate are expected this week to pass a $5 billion stopgap measure to keep things running. WBUR's Steve Brown says that'll give state lawmakers in a budget conference committee more flexibility.
Just to make sure that the bills are paid, and that way it gives the conferees who are working on that final budget a little more time. They're not under the gun to get it done by June 30th, which is the last day of the fiscal year.
If passed, the spending measure would take effect later this week. A retired Massachusetts state trooper will not serve any more prison time for overtime fraud. 51-year-old Paul Season of Southwick was convicted for collecting nearly $30,000 in overtime pay that he did not work. Judge today sentenced him to 1 day of prison time served. He will also have to pay a fine and restitution. Former Governor Deval Patrick's brother-in-law will spend more than 5 years in prison on rape, kidnapping, and stalking charges. 67-year-old Bernard Tsai was convicted last week. A judge sentenced him today. Tsai was also sentenced to 15 months probation for witness intimidation and assault and battery. Shuttle buses will replace evening train service on the Orange Line starting tonight between Wellington and Oak Grove. The service change will allow for track work to support a new fleet of Orange Line cars. Buses will run on evenings from Sunday through Thursday until early August. Time is 5:34.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by WPI, which in 1970 pioneered project-based learning to give students opportunities to help solve real-world problems. Since 2015, more than 130 colleges and universities have worked with WPI to customize their own project-based approaches, including 26 just last week. Learn more at WPI.edu.
In sports, the women's soccer team, U.S. women's soccer team, is moving on to the quarterfinals of the World Cup after beating Spain 2-1 today. The Red Sox will play the White Sox at Fenway tonight. In the forecast, increasing clouds overnight tonight with showers moving in tomorrow morning. Lows around 60 degrees. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from MD Anderson Cancer Center, where physicians treat all types of cancers with a team of nearly 21,000, all devoted to ending cancer and providing hope to patients. More at MakingCancerHistory.com. And Capital One, offering the Spark Cash Card for businesses. Committed to helping business owners turn purchases into meaningful investments that can help drive business forward. Capital One, what's in your wallet? More at CapitalOne.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Faced with a military provocation, say like Iran downing a U.S. drone last week, one possible response is a precise, limited attack. That is an approach taken by a number of recent presidents, a way to send a tough message while stopping short of war. It is also the approach President Trump took 2 years ago after he accused Syria's military of using chemical weapons against civilians.
Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched.
President Trump seemed ready to follow this playbook with Iran, but he called off airstrikes and reportedly ordered a cyber attack instead. Now, that move may point to the changing nature of warfare, and for that, we're joined now by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Mary Louise.
What do we actually know about these reported cyber attacks against Iran?
Well, the government is not acknowledging it publicly. President Trump tweeted about calling off the attacks. He hasn't said anything about a cyber attack, but according to the report, we're seeing, these were aimed at the computers of the Revolutionary Guards that control their missiles and their rockets. And we don't know how potent, how effective it might have been. One of the challenges you face when you carry out a cyber attack.
Administrations rarely acknowledge cyber attacks, whether or not they have taken place. But in general, is it fair to say we are seeing more cyber attacks under this administration?
Yeah, and we're hearing more about it. And the key figure here is General Paul Nakasone. He is head of both the National Security Agency and Cyber Command. The NSA gathers the information, monitors it. Cyber Command is the part that actually takes action. He's talked about being more aggressive in cyberspace. He's talked about sending cyber command forces to Europe to block Russian attempts during the midterm elections. And we've heard a report just last week about the U.S. planting malware in the Russian electrical grid. But, you know, we haven't seen deaths or major damage. So what would cross the threshold to make a cyber attack the equivalent of a conventional military attack? I put that to Jim Lewis, a former U.S. diplomat who's now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
That threshold is that anything that causes death or damage or destruction qualifies as an attack that would justify the use of force in response. If you stay below that, it's a gray area. So people are now playing in the gray area to see how much can I get away with.
Greg Myrie, another distinction, I suppose, between cyber and conventional military attacks, airstrikes, missile strikes, and so on, is when those strikes hit, you can see if they hit the target. Satellite imagery pops up. They can tell if they got it or not. With cyber, not so much.
Yeah, so how do you read the interpretation that the Iranians would have made on something like this? And so that's one of the challenges. But what we do know is a lot of these sort of limited strikes haven't been particularly effective in the past. The U.S. has gone after a number of leaders, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, Saddam Hussein in Iraq and others, and they haven't changed their actions over time. So what we saw here was something that sort of perhaps unique, where a president sort of came to the edge of a military strike and then opted for a cyber attack instead.
And to circle us back to Iran and whatever may or may not have happened, if there were cyber attacks against Iran, that would not be the first case of cyber between these two countries.
No, it would not. We've seen a number. The Stuxnet attack against their nuclear program. Iran has hit casinos in Las Vegas. They've hit banks. So we've had several rounds of these already and expect some more to come.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
NPR's Greg Myrie.
We have to be careful about how we report on this next Supreme Court ruling for reasons that you are about to understand. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is going to tiptoe through this 6-3 decision that has free speech advocates cheering. The case is about trademarking, quote, scandalous and immoral brand names.
The brand name at issue in the case is FUCT. You can say it. I can't. It's a casual clothing line owned by designer Eric Brunetti. Hoodies, t-shirts, etc., all with that brand name prominently displayed. Brunetti has been trying to get federal trademark protection for the line for years. With it, he will now have more clout in shutting down knockoffs. But the case he brought to the Supreme Court produced five separate opinions today. Justice Elena Kagan wrote the majority opinion, joined by the court's two most conservative justices, Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, plus its most liberal justice, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and another conservative, Justice Samuel Alito, who wrote separately. In dissent were two of the court's liberal justices, Sonia Sotomayor and Stephen Breyer, plus conservative Chief Justice John Roberts. In the aftermath of the decision, trademark attorney Jacqueline Lesser expects a rush to get trademark protection now for lots of vulgar and racist brands.
I do believe that this will open the door to indiscriminate applications for terms and words that many or most of us find to be really awful.
Ilya Shapiro of the Libertarian Cato Institute pooh-poohs that idea, noting there are lots of other restrictions on trademarks.
I'd like to see the business plan. You can't get a trademark for something that's already in common use or generic in a certain way.
Today's decision produced a fascinating debate among the justices. All nine agreed that the federal law banning immoral trademarks was just too broad, that it would allow the government to grant trademarks to messages it approved and deny trademarks for messages it disapproved. But the ban on scandalous trademarks, well, that's where the unanimity fell apart. Justice Kagan, writing for the majority, looked to dictionary definitions of scandalous: disgraceful, offensive, disreputable, for instance. Put that with immoral, she said, and what you have is a statute on its face that distinguishes between conventional moral standards and those hostile to them. Denied trademark protection, for instance, was you can't spell healthcare without THC. But granted trademark protection was say no to drugs. Granted trademark protection was a game called Praise the Lord and a line of clothing called Jesus Died for You. But denied was bong hits for Jesus. Summing up, Kagan said, "We hold that the law violates the First Amendment guarantee of free speech because it disfavors certain ideas." Justice Alito provided the sixth vote, but he wasn't happy about it. He was signing on, he said, because viewpoint discrimination is poison to a free society and because he sees free speech as under attack in modern America. But he specifically said the court's decision does not prevent Congress from adopting a statute that would ban vulgar terms that play no real part in the expression of ideas. The FUCT brand, he said, signifies nothing except emotion and a severely limited vocabulary. The three dissenters would have interpreted the existing statute as limited to profanity and vulgarity, perhaps even specific words, and under that interpretation, the dissenters would have upheld denying trademark protection for the FUCT brand. Congress, of course, could try to do that now by enacting a very narrow law that bans trademarks for profane and obscene speech, or it could enact a trademark ban for certain words, even the N-word. Congress has taken similar action to narrow other statutes struck down on First Amendment grounds. But as Genevieve Lakier of the University of Chicago Law School observes, it's never simple.
Vulgarity expresses a point of view. That's one of the reasons the government often wants to censor it.
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Now to Ethiopia, where the alleged mastermind of a coup attempt died during a firefight with security forces. The government accused the man, a brigadier general, of masterminding gun attacks on Saturday aimed at seizing power in a key northern region. The violence comes as the prime minister is transforming Ethiopia with political reforms that are meant to open the previously isolated nation. NPR's East Africa correspondent Ader Peralta joins us now. Hi, Ader.
Hey, Ari.
So tell us a little bit more about what happened over the weekend.
So there were two separate events. One of them happened in Amhara, as you said. And according to the government, a renegade brigadier general and his forces attacked the local government, and they killed the president of that region. A few hours after that attack, the top military official in Ethiopia, the chief of staff of the Ethiopian Armed Forces, was killed by his bodyguard just as he was coordinating a response to that situation in Amhara. And today we got news that the brigadier general died in a firefight with security forces. But I think the top line here is that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed continues to be tested in Ethiopia. Almost exactly a year ago, the government said intelligence agents had plotted to kill him when they threw a grenade. And this time, two of Abiy's very close allies have been killed.
So why is this northern region of Amhara important to Ethiopia?
I mean, historically, it's been the power center of Ethiopia. And more than a year ago, the people of Amhara joined the people of Oromia in a protest movement that toppled one of the most authoritarian governments in the world. So this region really is the alliance that brought Abiy to power. It's an important part of that alliance.
Now, I mentioned that the prime minister has put a bunch of political reforms into place, and he's generally been seen as a positive figure, at least internationally. So why is there so much opposition to what he's doing?
Yeah, I mean, he's a superstar on the continent. And one of the things that he has been lauded for is that when he came to power, he said, "This is a new Ethiopia that welcomes everyone." So literally everyone came back, all the politicians, the militants, the radical thinkers who had been shunned or jailed by the previous administration. And this brigadier general was one of those guys. He was in jail for planning a coup. But as Abiy came to power, he was pardoned. He was freed. And Abiy even returned his military rank. But this brigadier general, when he came onto the scene, he started talking about taking back land that he said historically belonged to the Amharas. He told people to pick up arms. But Prime Minister Abiy's theory has always been that these voices would be drowned out by the moderate ones. I spoke to Ethiopian journalist and political analyst Sekaria Salalem, and he says what the prime minister forgot is how dangerous some of these voices are coming from powerful men like this brigadier general. Let's listen to a bit of what he told me.
This is going to be the litmus test for Ethiopia, because right now there are demands from sections of the population that the government take a sort of Machiavellian hold and crack down on people promoting the sorts of narratives, the sorts of voices, the sorts of opinions that the Brigadier General was known for.
So to Sekarius, this is a pivotal moment in Ethiopia because it really gives the government a chance to say, look, Ethiopia can't handle a more open society and we have to return to a more authoritarian rule.
That's NPR's East Africa correspondent Eder Peralta speaking with us about the latest upheaval in Ethiopia. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ari.
This is All Things Considered.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, the opposition party in Turkey wins a landslide victory in the Istanbul mayoral race. Remember, if you like the programs Ask Me Another and The Moth, don't miss Ophira Eisenberg perform her unique blend of stand-up comedy and storytelling live at WBUR City Space this Wednesday night. Tickets at wbur.org/cityspace. In the forecast, increasing clouds tonight, lows around 60 degrees, showers moving in tomorrow morning. Right now, 76 degrees in Boston. The time is 5:49.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston University's Metropolitan College, offering part-time, evening, and online undergraduate degree completion programs. Earn your bachelor's degree via self-paced or accelerated program formats. Learn more at an information session Saturday, July 20th at 10:30 a.m. Sign up at bu.edu/met/info.
We go where the nation asks us to go, and we do what the nation requires us to do.
The Navy SEAL who oversaw the mission that took down Osama bin Laden is now retired. His new memoir recounts 37 years of service and credits others who put their lives on the line to help him succeed.
I certainly didn't make it to where I was as a result of my own wonderful talents.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Yesterday, Ekrem İmamoğlu was elected mayor of Istanbul again. He already won the race for mayor back in March, beating the candidate handpicked by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan then pushed for a new election, a do-over. This time, İmamoğlu, who had squeaked out just a narrow victory the first time around, he won in a landslide. With us to talk about it from Istanbul is Asla Aydıntaşbaş. She's a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and a longtime Turkish journalist. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hi, Marie-Louise. Good to be here.
Glad to have you with us. So I want to ask you about the new mayor in a second, but let's start with Erdogan and what the fallout for him might be. What's the impact on him of losing the city of Istanbul?
It's an incredible defeat. There is a saying in Turkish, whoever wins Istanbul wins Turkey. And also, elections in Turkey do not take place in a normal atmosphere. The government has full control over media, so the opposition basically relied on social media largely. But people of Istanbul, 16 million residents here, but 10 million voters, people of Istanbul were quite pissed off that their vote was cancelled. Election results at the end of the March were cancelled by an election board decision after the government's lobbying. So they really reacted to that.
So who is the guy who pulled this off? Who is Ekrem İmamoğlu, the incoming mayor of Istanbul?
Ekrem İmamoğlu was a no-name figure in Turkish politics until 6 months ago. He was the mayor of a small district in Istanbul, a middle-class, lower-middle-class district for the past couple of years. He's made a name for himself, and he has really differentiated himself from Erdogan against Erdogan's very divisive rhetoric of accusing pretty much all his opponents of being terrorists or linked to terrorists. He said, I am here to unite this city. I want to make peace with 16 million citizens. I am going to be a uniter, etc. He's sort of worked with Kurds, worked with conservatives, refusing the fault lines in Turkish society that had deepened so much over the last few years. Someone who makes a little heart sign at the end of each rally, someone who's really hugging people in street markets. And this was a contrast to increasingly more isolated ruling elite in Turkey who go around in big convoys and security, pretty much an army at this point. And I think it was clear that AKP, which had come to power as the representative of the people, had lost its touch.
AKP being Erdogan's party.
Exactly.
I mean, it's fascinating that people in Istanbul seem so determined to exercise their right to vote in a Turkey where Erdogan has exercised, I think fair to say, increasingly authoritarian power in recent years.
That's true. And I think that he's paying a price for that. There is a sense that enough is enough. Illiberalism, authoritarianism, constant sort of rhetoric of internal and external enemies, coupled with an economic recession, was too much. And I think they decided to send the government a message.
So are all signs that Erdogan and his party will accept the result of the vote this time around?
All signs are that Erdogan will accept the result. The question is, what is he going to do afterwards? Is he going to take the message from the voters, from Turkish citizens, and return to a democratic path, try to seek reforms, or is he going to go on, double down perhaps on authoritarianism, and try to suppress his opponents? Doing the latter would only deepen the crisis in Turkey. There is no doubt that people are pushing back at what they see as an overreach.
Asla Aydintashbash of the European Council on Foreign Relations speaking to us from Istanbul. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Author Judith Krantz pioneered what you could call the sex and shopping novel. Her stories featured heroines with big hair and bigger wardrobes. They pursued power, pleasure, and fabulous clothes with equal passion. Krantz died on Saturday at the age of 91. NPR Books editor Petra Mayer has this remembrance.
Reading Judith Krantz is like playing dress-up in the world's most glamorous closet, and then eating a plate of gold-leafed French pastries, and then popping a bottle of posh champagne.
It's pure pleasure and gluttonous, shameless excess.
That's author and big-time Judith Krantz fan Jennifer Weiner.
There wasn't a plot point that she didn't cram in there. There wasn't a description of a designer garment that you didn't get. There wasn't a sex scene that she didn't, like, linger over for 7 or 8 pages. I mean, they were wonderful.
Beginning with her first book, Scruples, in 1978, Krantz wrote about fashion moguls, princesses and publishers, pilots and nightclub singers and movie stars. And by the way, everyone in that list I just rattled off is a woman. Krantz's women wanted rich men and Chanel everything, but they also wanted growth and success on their own terms. Here's Valerie Bertinelli as Maxie Amberville, who remakes her father's stale old fashion magazine in the 1987 miniseries of I'll Take Manhattan.
Enough guilt! Enough about those extra pounds, or about how you don't know how to manage your money. Would any man buy a magazine every month that told him what a jerk he was? No, he would not!
Her solution? A magazine that loves women just the way they are. And of course, it's a smashing success, because in a Judith Krantz novel, women can have it all. Critics called Krantz's work trashy. Writing in the Washington Post, Michael Durda described her 1990 novel Dazzle as merely a string of romance narrative clichés tied loosely together by sex scenes every 50 or 60 pages, and snootily expressed sympathy for the paper, ink, and glue used to print it. Again, Jennifer Weiner.
She got so little respect. I mean, I haven't seen an obituary that hasn't included some variation on beloved by readers, reviled by critics. And I just wonder why we as a culture are so dismissive of things that bring women pleasure and joy.
But Krantz herself told the Boston Globe that she was past being upset by critical digs. "I write about beautiful places, elegant people, good food," she said. "I love the details that enrich life. My heroines are always wonderful. They may be flamboyant, but they're not cheap flamboyant." Krantz called herself the world's latest bloomer. She worked as a writer and editor at women's magazines for years, but didn't think about fiction until she was almost 50. She'd married television producer Steve Krantz in 1954. They were introduced by her pal Barbara Walters, and he pushed her to sit down at the typewriter for her first novel. It paid off when Scruples, about a frumpy ingenue who remakes herself as a high-fashion boutique owner, hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And her next novel, Princess Daisy, sold to a publisher for more than $3 million. The couple became a kind of cottage industry, with Steve Krantz producing lavish TV movies and miniseries based on his wife's work.
I love you. And I want to be your mistress.
That's from the 1980 TV version of Scruples. Kranz's last novel came out in 1998, though she did write a memoir called Sex and Shopping, The Confessions of a Nice Jewish Girl, great title, in 2000. Judith Kranz died at home in her Bel Air mansion, surrounded by antiques, dogs, family, Hermes handbags, and her massive collection of Chanel suits. She was 91. Petra Mayer, NPR News.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Progressive Insurance. Offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool, custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world, committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com. And the Economic Development Authority of Fairfax County, Virginia, located near D.C. and home to 8,900 technology companies and 144,000 technology jobs. Details at fairfaxcountyeda.org.
This is WBUR. Coming up next hour on All Things Considered, San Francisco, home of Juul, considers a ban on all e-cigarette products. In the forecast, increasing clouds tonight, lows around 60 degrees. Right now, 76 degrees in Boston at 559.
WBUR supporters include the Advanced Heart Failure Program at Beth Israel Deaconess. Personalized treatments and advanced technologies for all stages of heart failure. BIDMC is part of Beth Israel Lahey Health. And Mass Art, preparing artists, designers, and art educators for creative careers on their Boston campus. massart.edu/discover.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston.
92.7 WBUA Tisbury.
89.1 WBUH Brewster.
Streaming at WBUR.org.
And live at City Space, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
President Trump imposes new sanctions on Iran as the U.S. tries to build a coalition to deter attacks in the Persian Gulf or the Gulf of Oman. It's Monday, June 24th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good evening. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Coming up, the White House has already imposed more than 1,000 sanctions on Iran in the past year. So what will the latest step accomplish?
We have sanctions to go after the Supreme Leader's office and lock up literally billions of dollars more of assets.
Also this hour, how market forces are driving a solar energy boom in Georgia where there are no state mandates promoting it. And at 6:30 on Marketplace, a look at how Toys R Us is trying to mount a comeback after declaring bankruptcy last year. It's 6:01. First, this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The United States is announcing additional sanctions against Iran. It says are designed to force Tehran to the negotiating table. The new sanctions come as top U.S. diplomats visit Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries to build support for policies towards Iran. NPR's Ruth Sherlock sat down with U.S. Special Representative to Iran Brian Hook in Oman.
Special Representative Hook claimed that political and economic pressure are the only way to bring Tehran to the negotiating table.
They face a choice. They can either watch their economy crumble or they can come and talk to the United States. And we believe that at some point, better thinking is going to prevail in Tehran.
He rejected critics' allegations that such a tough stance is pushing Iran to further aggression, claiming that the U.S. is offering Tehran several diplomatic off-ramps. And he warned this U.S. diplomatic pressure does not give Tehran a license to respond with violence. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Muscat, Oman.
A U.S. District Court judge in Maryland says new evidence paints what he calls a disturbing picture of the motive behind the Trump administration's push to ask everyone in the country about citizenship status as part of the 2020 census. Last week, U.S. District Court Judge George Hazel ruling there's enough evidence to warrant the reopening of a case focused on whether the proposed census question is a violation of minority rights. In the filing, Hazel cited newly discovered emails showing the question intended to discriminate. Wherever the Supreme Court could render that decision moot, it decides this week whether the controversial question should be included. President Trump signed an executive order today on price transparency in health care. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin has more.
Today, President Trump called on the Department of Health and Human Services to develop rules allowing patients to see health care prices up front.
With this order, hospitals will be required to publish prices that reflect what people actually pay for services.
Trump made remarks at the White House before signing the executive order.
More price transparency will mean more competition, and the cost of health care will go way, way down.
Nothing will happen right away. This essentially kicks off a lengthy rulemaking process. Some patient advocates cheered the news. Healthcare industry groups representing hospitals and insurers said it would be bad for consumers and could push prices up. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
Senator Bernie Sanders and some progressives in the House are going even further than fellow presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren in offering a remedy to the high level of student loan debt. Sanders and his group putting forth a plan that would cancel all student debt affecting some 45 million Americans. Both Sanders and Warren are among 20 Democratic hopefuls vying for the nomination who will be taking part in televised debates this week. On Wall Street, a mixed close. The Dow gained 8 points to 26,727. The Nasdaq was down 26 points. The S&P 500 closed down 5 points today. You're listening to NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. MBTA officials are forming an independent review panel to assess safety practices in Boston's transit system. WBUR's Jerome Campbell has this report.
The panel consists of experts who have led New York's transit system and the Federal Transit Administration, as well as former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood. Their goal will be to examine past incidents on the T, like this month's derailments on the red and green lines, and recommend changes. Monica Tibbetts-Nutt sits on the MBTA's governing board and says the review panel is a serious effort to hold the transit system accountable.
So I just want the public to know we are going to be transparent, we are going to work as fast as we can, and we are all pulling in the same direction to not only improve our processes, but to improve the services.
The review panel is expected to announce what they will focus on in the coming weeks. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jerome Campbell.
A West Springfield man's now been charged in a deadly crash in Randolph, New Hampshire that's killed 7 motorcyclists. Vladimir Zukovsky was arrested this morning and arraigned in court this afternoon in western Massachusetts. He's being charged with 7 counts of negligent homicide for last Friday's crash. Police say he was driving the truck that collided with the bikers. They were part of a motorcycle club for Marines and their spouses. Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins will have a Democratic challenger in her re-election bid next year if she chooses to run. House Speaker Sarah Gideon says today she will run against Collins, who's been in office since 1996. Gideon is a 4-term state representative. She's the second person to declare as a Democratic candidate. It's getting cheaper to drive to your summer getaway. AAA now says a gallon of regular gas costs $2.64 in Massachusetts. That's down 3 cents from last week and is 2 cents lower than the national average. Sports, the U.S. women's soccer team moves on to the quarterfinals in the World Cup after beating Spain 2-1 today. They play France on Friday. Red Sox play the White Sox at Fenway tonight. In the forecast, increasing clouds tonight, lows around 60 degrees. Showers tomorrow morning, rain in the afternoon. Highs in the mid-70s. Right now, 77 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Ken and Lucy Lehman family, who appreciate that for 3 decades, NPR has helped them to better understand a complex nation and world through its in-depth coverage of events, ideas, and cultures.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. After President Trump announced last week that he had called off airstrikes against Iran, he promised to take other non-military measures to increase pressure on the country. Now, today, we are getting a sense of what those measures are. A new set of sanctions and an effort to build up a maritime coalition in the Persian Gulf to deter further Iranian attacks. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
President Trump is now taking aim at Iran's supreme leader and is expected to single out Iran's foreign minister for sanctions later in the week.
Sanctions imposed through the executive order that I'm about to sign will deny the supreme leader and the supreme leader's office and those closely affiliated with him and the office access to key financial resources and support.
He calls it a strong and proportionate response to Iran's provocative actions. Last week, the president cited concerns about potential casualties when he called off a military strike against Iran that had been drawn up in response to the downing of a U.S. drone. Asked whether the sanctions were in response to that, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says, in part.
Some of this was in the works. Some of this is a result of recent activities.
And not just the downing of the drone. The Trump administration also blames Iran for recent attacks on tankers in the Gulf of Oman. Iran's ambassador to the UN, Majid Ravanchi, denies that. He's calling on the U.S. to stop its, quote, military adventurism in the Persian Gulf. His comments came as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visited Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to build up a coalition to deter Iran. Separately, Special Representative Brian Hook was visiting Oman, describing his meetings this way.
We've talked about ways that we can enhance maritime security and do what we can to restore deterrence in this part of the region, which needs to be more stable and more secure.
U.S. officials are calling it the Sentinel program. The idea is to keep eyes on all shipping in the region. Officials won't say what countries are likely to join or what exactly they will do. As one U.S. official put it, there will be cameras, binoculars, and ships, including from the U.S. As he sat down with Emirati leaders today, Secretary Pompeo made clear that President Trump is keen to share the burden. Pompeo calls on military folks in the United Arab Emirates to participate in the maritime security effort and says another 20 countries are needed for what's likely to be a lengthy campaign. Ilan Goldenberg of the Center for a New American Security was working in the Pentagon when the Obama administration faced similar challenges from Iran in 2011 and 12.
And what the U.S. did at that moment was less loud huffing and puffing, more quiet signaling, very firmly signaling to the Iranians in private that this was unacceptable, and that if they kept going, they risked a major conflict with the United States.
He says that message got through loud and clear. The current point person on Iran, Brian Hook, says there are no back channels operating now with Iran, but he insists the Trump administration is giving Iran what he calls off-ramps. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
So is this new policy on Iran loud huffing and puffing or a strong and proportionate response? Well, for one view on it, we are joined by Suzanne Maloney. She was an advisor to the State Department on Iran issues during the George W. Bush administration, and she is now with the Brookings Institution. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we heard the president say that these sanctions are going to deny access to key financial resources from the senior leaders of Iran. Do you have a sense of what exactly the sanctions are going to do?
I think that may be a bit of an overstatement about denying key economic resources to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran is already heavily sanctioned. In fact, many of the organizations and institutions that are associated with the Office of the Supreme Leader that were highlighted in today's announcement have already been subject to American sanctions. I think the purpose of the announcement today was, at least to some extent, about the huffing and puffing that Ilan Goldenberg mentioned in the prior commentary. But it's also, I think, a reaction to some sense that there was an appearance that the policy had begun to soften a bit. Yeah. Because of the president's decision not to retaliate and some of his seemingly conciliatory rhetoric over the weekend.
Right. So after a year or so of what the Trump administration describes as a maximum pressure campaign on Iran, how do you increase the pressure from maximum, I guess, is the question.
Well, and that's the dilemma that the administration is beginning to face, that once you've sanctioned all of the major industries and sectors of the Iranian economy, there's very little that you can do that's not already redundant or just largely incremental. It also, I think, highlights the fact that the Iranian economy, what's left of it, has become more insular and less interconnected, which means whatever economic activity continues in Iran today is going to be more resilient to U.S. penalties.
Now, the White House says this is all a means of getting Iran to the negotiating table. Do you think these steps are likely to do that, are likely to have that effect?
I think it's very much unclear that new economic measures are going to really create an incentive for the Iranians to come to the negotiating table. In particular, the threat, as we've heard today, to sanction the Iranian foreign minister would seem to fly in the face of any real effort to negotiate. That said, I think there is some constituency on the part of the Iranian system to try to see what might be possible, to explore what might be viable in terms of some kind of a quid pro quo with the Trump administration, simply because they're so aware that the president himself appears to be fixated on the possibility of some kind of symmetry with Iran.
Do you think there's a risk that increasing the pressure will lead Iran to be more aggressive and take more steps like shooting down the U.S. drone as it did last week?
Well, I think we were likely to see that in the aftermath of the events of last week, President Trump's decision to reverse his initial support for a military strike on Iran and then tweet about it publicly, I think was likely read as weakness from the Iranian leadership. And fundamentally, they haven't gotten what they need out of this escalatory strategy. They're looking to see a mitigation of economic pressure, and they haven't seen that yet.
That's Suzanne Maloney. She served as an advisor to the State Department on Iran issues during the George W. Bush administration. She's now at the Brookings Institution. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The country's biggest e-cigarettes company, Juul Labs, calls San Francisco home. That has not stopped the city's board of supervisors from taking up a vote tomorrow. It is considering a bill to ban the sale of e-cigarettes. Reporter Laura Clivens of member station KQED has the story.
15-year-old Abby Chaitin has lived in San Francisco her whole life. She doesn't really see the draw of using e-cigarettes, which her friends just call vaping.
Because I've noticed how addicted my peers have become to, like, vaping.
She sits on her bed in her purple room. There's a Breakfast Club poster on the wall, and you can see San Francisco's summer fog out her window. She told me the majority of her friends have tried vaping, and a few are now hooked.
I'll see them in class, like, fidgeting, or, like, they need it to focus, to function.
Last year, one in five high school seniors reported vaping in the past month. That's almost double the number who reported vaping the year before. Even eighth graders are vaping in record numbers.
We're going to fight hard to stop that.
San Francisco supervisor Shimon Walton co-authored the new ordinance.
We spent a few decades fighting big tobacco in the form of cigarettes, and now we have to do it again in the form of e-cigarettes.
The proposed law would ban selling e-cigarettes in the city and delivering them to San Francisco addresses. That means you couldn't even order them online. In California, it's illegal for anyone under 21 to buy tobacco products, both regular and e-cigarettes. Still, Walton says vaping devices are common in the city's middle and high schools. He points out that nicotine, no matter how you ingest it, can harm a young person's developing brain.
And now we're just trading one nicotine addiction for another.
Juul's vaping device, also called a Juul, was introduced in 2015. The company now controls 70% of the vaping market. Company officials say they also want to keep e-cigarettes away from young people. They say they've made it harder for underage buyers to purchase Juul off their website, and Juul shut down its accounts on Facebook and Instagram. But the company argues banning e-cigarettes will mean adults who want to quit smoking regular cigarettes will have a harder time. San Francisco resident Jay Friedman agrees. The software engineer used to smoke a pack a day for 20 years.
E-cigarettes have really gotten me down to smoking like two or three a day.
Friedman supported a ban on flavored tobacco that city voters passed last year.
I feel like it was a good step to get rid of the fruit flavors for kids, but this feels like maybe a step too far.
He says if e-cigarettes are banned, he would try to quit nicotine altogether. But
there would be a point and a moment of weakness where I just end up buying a pack of smokes again, and then it's just a slippery slope from there.
City supervisors worry that for every adult that might benefit, dozens of young people could become addicted. Small businesses in San Francisco are concerned the ban will hurt their bottom line.
Hey, how's it going?
Miriam Zazunis and her family own this convenience store near downtown San Francisco, Ted's Market.
When people come and want to purchase something at the store and we don't have that exact item that they want, they're not going to buy the rest of the items that they might on that trip, a drink or a sandwich, if we don't have their type of tobacco product.
She says sales from e-cigarettes are at least $200 to $300 a day. And as a board member of the Arab American Grocers Association, she believes laws like this mostly affect immigrant-owned businesses. If passed, the ban would go into effect early next year. But 15-year-old Abby Chaitin thinks it won't make much of a difference.
People my age can find a way around that if they really need to.
Meanwhile, Jewel is collecting signatures for a ballot initiative to override the ban in November. For NPR News, I'm Laura Clivens in San Francisco.
And the story is part of a reporting partnership with NPR News, KQED, and Kaiser Health News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wentworth Institute of Technology. Part-time grad degrees, in person and online. For careers in project, technology, and facilities management, WIT.edu.
This is WBUR, online at WBUR.org. Coming up on All Things Considered, why Georgia's solar power market is booming despite the lack of state mandates supporting it. On Wall Street today, it was a mixed day for the markets. The Dow rose 8 points to close at 26,727. NASDAQ, though, fell 26 points to 8,005. The S&P 500 also down. It lost 5 points to end the day at 2,945. More business news coming up at 6:30 on Marketplace. Right now, the time is 6:18.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by New England Honda dealers, presenting the all-wheel drive 2019 CR-V and Pilot. You can learn more at HondaDealersOfNewEngland.com. Around here, we Honda. And Shakespeare & Company, Lenox, Massachusetts, presenting the romantic comedy Twelfth Night, directed by Alan Burroughs on the main stage, July 2nd through August 4th, Shakespeare.org.
Coming up at WBUR City Space on Tuesday, July 16th, a screening of a new documentary about legendary 60 Minutes reporter Mike Wallace, who interviewed some of the most important figures of the 20th century. Go to WBUR.org/cityspace for more information. In the forecast, we'll see clouds moving in tonight with rain tomorrow. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
Muggy weather develops late tonight as skies become mostly cloudy and temperatures fall from their daily highs down towards 60 by Tuesday morning. There might be an early shower tomorrow, but the bulk of the rain is going to hold off till the evening commute. Temperatures in the lower 70s, you'll definitely feel the humidity by then. On Wednesday, we'll look for a pop-up storm, otherwise just a blend of clouds and sunshine, low, perhaps middle 80s. On Thursday, mid to upper 80s, cooler at the coast, maybe an isolated shower or a thunderstorm. Friday, very warm and humid, temperatures in the 80s. And Saturday, humid as well, temperatures still in the low to mid 80s.
Right now, it's 77 degrees in Boston at 620. This is 90.9 WBUR.
WBUR supporters include Walnut Hill School for the Arts in Natick. For student artists in grades 9 through 12, still accepting applications for fall admission, walnuthillarts.org/admission.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As states consider what, if anything, to do about climate change, one thing more than half of them have done is set mandates around renewable energy. In many places, that's driving the growth of wind and solar. But it's not happening everywhere. Today and tomorrow, I'm going to take you on a road trip to a state that proudly has no such mandate, Georgia. My home state. Again, no mandates requiring clean energy, and yet Georgia is in the middle of a solar power boom. And I can tell you that with confidence because I just drove it top to bottom. We started in Dalton, North Georgia, near the Tennessee state line. When I was a kid growing up in Georgia, when someone said Dalton, you said Corpus. I mean, this was a one-horse town for a long time.
Oh, absolutely.
Dalton Mayor Dennis Mock, who assures me Dalton is still, quote, the carpet capital of the world. They make all kinds of floor coverings, actually, laminates, hardwood, tiles. And then last year, a company from Korea came knocking.
They showed up, we liked them, and they liked us, and that's how it works.
The company was Hanwha Qcells. This January, 5 months ago, here in Dalton, Georgia, production began at the biggest solar assembly factory in the Western Hemisphere.
When we go out on the floor, there are a lot of moving pieces, so
if we can all stay together.
Our guide, Lisa Nash, she helped hire the 600 people this factory now employs.
We've just stepped through a couple of double doors onto the main factory floor. It's about a football field and a half long, getting the lay of the land of the production line here.
Actually, three production lines side by side, operating 24/7. Around us, solar cells are getting slotted into frames. Workers are checking for defects. I'm trying to wrap my head around the scale of the place when a kind of critter forklift approaches.
What are these little robot cars I just saw scooting around for?
Those are heisters.
Heisters. They're basically unmanned forklifts, and they are hauling pallets of finished panels around. Almost all the machinery here was shipped over from Korea, so the final solar product could be assembled here in Georgia. And my question for Scott Moskowitz, Director of Strategy and Market Intelligence, is why? Why Georgia?
Why Georgia? Well, first of all, the U.S. is the second largest solar market in the world. It will be for the foreseeable future.
He's led us up to a conference room. We have peeled off the big plastic goggles and paper booties we were required to wear on the factory floor. Moskowitz says locating in Georgia made sense in part because a lot of customers want to do the tour we have just done, see firsthand how their panels are made.
The vast majority of these will end up in projects in the U.S. and many of them in projects in the Southeast because this is the largest region for solar installations over the next 5 years.
So demand is high.
Demand for solar is high and growing.
Then there's the matter of tariffs. Scott Moskowitz says they were already eyeing the U.S. market when President Trump slapped a 30% tariff on solar imports. Just 4 months later, May 2018, Hanwha Qcells announced this plant.
Tariffs have made it such that for the time being, this is the most attractive place to assemble panels for use in the U.S. market.
Okay, now let me introduce another player on the solar scene here in Georgia, Facebook. Yes, Facebook is headquartered on the other side of the country, but they are behind one of the first orders for this factory in Dalton. Last year, around the same time Hanwha Qcells was sniffing around in Dalton, Facebook announced plans to build a giant data center just a couple of hours' drive southeast. So we point our car down I-75 towards our next stop.
I have now driven out east of Atlanta. We're in Newton County, Georgia. I'm looking out over a massive building site with cement mixers and dumpsters and all kinds of construction equipment. This is the future site of what a lot of people we've met here in Georgia are describing to us as a game changer for solar in Georgia.
That is because the building taking shape in front of me, when it comes online next year, it is going to require as much energy as a small to mid-size city. Facebook's data centers house the servers that process every time you like a post or comment on a friend's. Paul Clemens runs the Facebook team that scouts new locations. He told me when he originally came hunting a couple years ago, he noticed something.
It's very sunny in the south part of Georgia, yet renewable energy was not really taking off in the state.
Which he saw as an opportunity. The field was wide open. Facebook could tailor the kind of solar deal it wanted in Georgia. And market forces were cooperating. The price of solar has been falling and falling more than 70% over the last decade.
We found that when we go into new regions and we're able to access renewable energy, that we typically are able to achieve lower electricity rates than we would through a normal non-green energy solution.
Which matters because Facebook has set a company goal: support all its electricity needs with 100% renewable energy by next year. Here in Georgia, the utility that is giving Facebook access to all that renewable energy is Walton EMC, headquartered about 20 miles back north from the Facebook construction site. We roll up and are greeted by
Greg Brooks, and I'm the Community and Public Relations Director.
Brooks says his customers want solar, big customers such as Facebook and your everyday Joe. But some people's roofs are too shady, some people don't want solar panels on top of their houses, some people can't afford them. So Brooks brings us out to see one of the community solar installations they have built, kind of sort of like a community garden.
So it is a scorcher of a day here in Georgia. It's going to be 90-something degrees again. We've just driven to, you said this is the smallest of the community lots you've got going?
4,200 panels takes about 6 acres.
how this works. If you are a Walton EMC customer, you can opt to pay $25 a month. You get a block of solar panels in the community plot and a credit on your bill. It has been popular. So popular, the first two installations sold out in days. Now, renewables account for a tiny fraction of the energy mix Walton EMC provides customers.
It is still less than 1%.
That is soon to change, though, thanks to Facebook. The amount of power that Facebook will gobble up means Walton EMC has to build a couple new solar plants to serve them. I mean, how big a deal is that for a company like Walton EMC?
It's a huge deal.
A game-changer kind of deal, or?
I would say so. We're actually getting calls from other companies now. Their corporate philosophy and policy is that they want to do renewable, too.
Now, I should point out the obvious. Solar does not work at night, does not work when it rains, so there are going to be times when Facebook will have to rely on fossil fuels. When the sun is out, those new solar farms will send more clean energy to the grid than Facebook can use during the day, and that excess will count towards their renewable energy goal.
Solar is a valuable piece of the energy mix, but I don't ever see us going to 100% of any one fuel source.
Then again, Greg Brooks never thought he would be standing here in 2019 next to rows and rows of solar panels talking about the solar boom in Georgia.
Even 10 years ago, I didn't think so because it was so expensive. It's amazing. To me, this is the most fun project I've worked on in my career.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Why?
It kind of gets us back to our roots because the people we were invented to serve planted something in a field and the sun shined on it, and they harvested that crop. And we planted these solar panels out here, and we're harvesting what the sun has given us to serve our members. So that's kind of neat.
Now, land near Atlanta is expensive. So the solar farms for Facebook, they are going up in the south of the state. Our road trip continues tomorrow. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR, online at WBUR.org. Coming up next at 6:30, it's Marketplace. Today, how Toys R Us is trying to mount a comeback after declaring bankruptcy last year. That's up next in the forecast. Increasing clouds tonight, lows around 60 degrees. Showers move in tomorrow morning after the commute with a possible thunderstorm later in the day. Highs in the mid-70s. Wednesday, mostly cloudy, chance for a pop-up storm, highs in the mid-80s. Right now, 77 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the reimagined 2020 Mercedes-Benz GLE with optional third-row seating and natural voice recognition. More at mbusa.com. And the Cabot in Beverly, presenting Art Garfunkel. The legendary 8-time Grammy-winning singer and Rock and Roll Hall of Famer performs Sunday, July 14th. Tickets at thecabot.org.